Washington, D.C. When Tony walked into the kitchen, she saw the microscope. It sat on the table, a red ribbon bow stuck to it. She was stunned, a total surprise. "Alex, where are you?" After a moment, he came into the kitchen, grinning. "You shouldn't have done this," she waved at the scope.
"Yeah, I should have. I've been slack in my husbandly duties lately."
"I hadn't noticed that."
"Not those duties. The, expectant father ones."
"It's a beautiful piece of equipment," she said, touching the scope mount with one hand. "But we can't afford it."
"We can. I had enough left in the car account to get it. You deserve it."
"It was a want, not a need."
"Ah, you needed it. I could tell."
She smiled and realized she hadn't been doing enough of that lately. "Thank you, darling."
"I got two lenses to do whatever it is it is supposed to do so you can work under it. Well, go set it up and see how it works."
"Later. I have something else in mind first."
"What else could be more important?"
"Come along and I'll show you." Now it was his turn to laugh. Tony headed for the bedroom, and Alex was right behind her. Santa Monica, California. The Hammer was coming on by the time Tad left the movie theater. Like he thought, there hadn't been any surveillance cams set up in the theater proper. There was one installed in the ready teller in the lobby, but neither he nor Bobby had used the money machine when the Z-ster had done his private showing. There wasn't any need. Everything had been on the tab Ziegler ran. By the time he got to the gym, the chem was working pretty good in Tad. It had come on faster than usual. Maybe it was because he had tripped such a short time ago and was still wrung out. Whatever. Thor was on a roll, urging Tad to join him in a night of ass-kicking, and it was all Tad could do to maintain control. Steve's gym was an upscale place just off PCH that catered to serious jocks. Tad pushed open the door, got a blast of frigid AC in the face, and almost had an orgasm from the cold rush. Lifting weights had never been Tad's thing. As a kid, his lungs had been too bad. Between that and his naturally skinny frame, he was never going to be able to bulk up, so he had never tried. With the Hammer working, he could probably go over and grab one of those big barbells and twirl it like a drum majorette's baton if he wanted to. But why bother? Nobody here he wanted to impress.
"Can I help you?"
came a deep voice from off to Tad's right. He looked. There was a woman there who looked like the Incredible Hulk's sister. She was big, heavy, ugly, and looked as if she needed a shave. But she had tits, fake ones, and the red leotard she wore showed an absence of male equipment down south. A definite woman, sort of. Tad smiled, enjoying a particularly nice rush.
"Steve around?"
According to Bobby, Steve was the owner of the gym. He was a former Mr. America, Mr. Universe, and Mr. whatever came after that. Past his prime, but still big as a rhino. Anyway, Bobby had told him to talk to Steve, who'd be happy to help out any friend of Bobby's. Bobby dropped a lot of money in this place, doing private sessions, buying T-shirts and vitamins and shit. The Amazon said,
"He's with the client right now. Maybe I can help you."
Her expression at seeing his pipe-stem frame and his black clothes said she didn't really think she could help him.
"Nah, it's personal biz. He's going to be about an hour. You can wait if you want."
Normally, Tad might have gone for that. An hour was nothing when he was straight. Well, more or less straight. But when the Hammer was pounding in your brain, doing nothing for an hour when you were in the gotta-move stage was pretty much impossible. Another body rush swept over Tad, and as it did, he got an erection. He looked at the woman bodybuilder. She probably outweighed him by 30 or 40 pounds, and no way, no how was she his type. But she was female, and she was right here.
"You want a screw? I bet I can wear you out in an hour."
The woman laughed.
"Oh, wow, that's really funny. You and me?"
Tad smiled pleasantly.
"Even if I was into men, which I'm not, you'd be the last guy I'd choose, Fuzzbrain. I'd want somebody who could pick me up and put me down easy, and you don't look like you could pick up an empty beer bottle without help."
Tad continued to smile. Quickly, he stepped up to her, scooped her up, and held the startled bodybuilder cradled in his arms like a baby.
"You mean like this? So I passed the test, right?"
With that, he used his left arm to support her weight, reached over with his right hand, caught the leotard between her breasts, and ripped it down the front all the way to the crotch. The woman was so startled by what he had done, her mouth just gaped.
"Nice hooters. You get a good deal on them?"
Tad stuck his hand between her legs, and whatever surprise she felt faded enough for her to scream and punch him at the same time. The cavalry arrived then, three guys who together probably weighed as much as a small car.
"Hey, what the fuck are you doing?" one of them said. "Put Belinda down, asshole!" "You got a security cam set up in here?" Tad asked. "You're damn straight we do, you fucking psycho!" "Where is it?"
"Charlie, call the cops, and call an ambulance for this moron," the guy said.
"You must be Steve, right?"
"That's right, Dickweed, and you're dead. Put her down." Tad grinned as the hammer came up full blast, roaring in like a tornado.
"Here," he said.
He threw Belinda at the three. All of them tumbled to the floor, hard. Tad leaped at Charlie, grabbed him under the armpits, and lifted him into the air.
"Which way is the security cam control room?"
Charlie pointed. Since Steve was almost back on his feet, Tad turned and threw Charlie at him. Tad ran for the unmarked door. There was a video monitor and a computer set up, a big hard drive working. Tad glanced around. No diskettes stacked up anywhere. No removable drives on the shelves. He moved closer and divined that the security device was no more than it appeared to be, a short-time recorder that ran a cycle, recording over and over using the same storage device. He grabbed the thing, smashed it against the floor, and shattered it into several pieces. The HD disk popped out, and he picked that up and broke it in half, then stuck the pieces in his back pocket. Never knew but what they could recover stuff, even if it was busted. He started for the door. Steve, too stupid to know when he was outmatched, came at Tad, swinging a steel bar. Tad dodged, ducked, and the bar whistled over his head, slammed into the wall, and punched a long hole in the sheetrock. The force of Steve's swing buried the steel rod half its length in the wall. Tad drove his knee into Steve's kidney, and the big man went down as if his legs had suddenly vanished. Nobody else got in Tad's way as he left the building. He headed for his car. Nobody came after him. Just as well, too. He'd enjoyed wrestling with the folks in the gym, and if they'd come out for him, why, he would have just had to oblige them. Now that that was over, he could relax and let the hammer swing him along. Gonna be a good night. Yes, sir, he could tell.
Let's move it, Thor.
Newport Beach, California. The Newport Beach Community Presbyterian Church, USA, was not as ostentatious as, say, the Crystal Palace, but certainly it was L.A., in-your-face enough so that it wouldn't pass for a church most other places. The building had a lot of glass, giving it a light and airy look. The place sure didn't seem somber enough for a funeral, and most of the mourners were wearing anything but black. Looked like a flock of parakeets, all the pastel colors. What could you expect? It was L.A., wasn't it? Drain had managed to dig up a dark suit, a white shirt, and a plain tie that were all 5 or 6 years old, unworn for almost that long, knowing that if he came in a T-shirt and shorts, his father would probably pull his gun and shoot him. Despite the fact he was pushing 70, the old man still looked pretty healthy. His hair was white, and his fair skin was now a ruddy color from spending more time out of doors in the Arizona sunshine. Drain knew he looked just like a younger version of his father. Assuming he lived so long, the old man was what Drain was going to look like at his age. Amazing, that. His father stood outside the church, looking at his watch, waiting for Drain.
"Robert," his father said. "Dad, let's go inside. We'll sit with Edwina."
People were still filing in. The service wouldn't start for another 20 minutes. Drain knew that his father would be early and that he expected everybody in the family to be early, and so it was. Drain offered condolences to his aunt and uncle and cousins. His father said,
"How are things at work, Robert?"
"Fine. I'm up for a promotion. They are considering me for head of polymers. Be worth another $10,000 a year.
"Congratulations."
"How is Arizona? The dog okay?"
"Fine. The dog is fine."
That pretty much exhausted everything Drain and his father usually said to each other, but Drain felt an urge to poke at his father.
"You hear about what happened at HQ in L.A.?"
There was no need to identify HQ. That was all it had ever been called in their family, HQ.
"I heard."
Drane wanted to grin, of course, but that would have been inappropriate in this place at this time.
Sounds like something you'd pull.
For a second, Drane felt a cold splash of terror.
What?
I haven't forgotten the incident in your English class. His tone was stern, disapproving. He felt a sense of relief and at the same time of irritation. Jesus Christ, the old man was still pissed off about that? Drane hadn't thought about it in years. It had been nothing. He'd made a little stink bomb. Drane had been 14 in the 8th grade. He'd gotten 2 days off to consider the heinousness of his crime, and the old man had taken his belt to him when he found out, and never let him forget it.
I'm not 14 anymore, Dad. That was a long time ago.
I didn't say you did it. I said it sounded like the kind of childish prank you used to do.
Drane didn't say anything, but it pissed him off that the old man was still throwing up ancient history in his face. Even though he had done the FBI prank, that shouldn't have been the first thing out of the old man's mouth.
Nobody got hurt, did they? Drane finally said.
But they could have been. People unwittingly exposed to drugs are at risk. What if some of the agents or staff had been allergic to the drug, on medication that it might have interacted with? What if there had been some kind of emergency needing a prompt response? A fire in the building, maybe a bank robbery or a kidnapping, and they had been unable to respond properly. The idiot who thought it was funny didn't think about those things, you may be sure. It was an irresponsible criminal act, and he'll be caught and punished for it. I hope they lock him up and lose the key.
Drane gritted his teeth. It would be a bad idea to say anything. But he couldn't help himself.
From the reports, it didn't sound as if they had any leads. Maybe the guy was too smart for him.
The old man turned to look at Drane.
Do you admire this criminal, Robert? Is that what you're saying? Didn't you learn anything from your upbringing?
Drane flushed, but finally realized it was time to keep silent. He just shook his head.
Yeah, Dad, I learned plenty. Much more than you will ever know.
Malibu, California. Tad was still up, though about to crash, watching the morning bunnies and studs jog along the beach. Man, he was wasted. As the chemicals of the hammer faded and lost their grip on him, he felt a bone-deep weariness begin to claim him. This was going to be a hard one to recover from. Best thing to do would be to take a shitload of downers and sleep for as long as he could. Bobby, off at his cousin's funeral, wasn't going to be too happy with him when he found out about Tad busting up the gym. Probably they wouldn't want to be seen hanging together for a while in case old Steve the bodybuilder ran into them somewhere and made the connection. Tad didn't think the gym rats knew he was tight with Bobby, but book it. They weren't going to forget him after last night. It would probably be in the papers and on the tube. Well, at least there weren't any public recordings of the Z-ster and Bobby floating around. That was the important thing. Quantico, Virginia. Michaels put a pair of dollar coins into the soft drink machine and pushed the button marked Coke. Change clattered into the return as the plastic bottle hit the bottom slot and rolled into view. He took the Coke out, fed the change back into the machine, added another dollar coin, and looked at Jay Gridley.
Club soda, Jay said.
Michaels pushed the button. $3 for two soft drinks. What a racket.
So you can't come up with any history on Frick and Frack other than they were at a conference at the same time 20 years ago as teenagers?
Nope. I know there's something there, but I haven't found it yet.
Well, don't kill yourself looking. It probably doesn't mean anything anyway. Better you should concentrate on the drug thing. We find what they want, they are off our back. Any leads there?
Nothing to speak of. The local cops and the DEA are all over Ziegler's place like white on rice. They figure if they backtrack him enough, they might find something.
You don't?
Maybe, but I wouldn't bet on it. Guy like that, big-time movie star, he probably didn't play golf with his connection. I'd be real surprised if he had a listing in his address book under dope dealer.
Michaels shrugged.
So how do we run the dealer? Wait for somebody else to go berserk and backtrack them?
Don't have to wait. Apparently some guy walked into a gym in Santa Monica last night and laid waste to the place. Threw some guys bigger than Hercules around like rag dolls when they objected to him feeling up the woman working the desk, who apparently was pretty well built herself. Knocked doors down, punched holes in the walls, like that.
The police have him?
Nope, he got away. We got the description. He sounds like a beatnik from what the witnesses said. And we have the police sketch.
Jay grinned, and Michaels joined him. Police sketches all seemed to look alike, and not very much like any of the guys they were supposed to represent. Plug a saint into an ID kit, he'd come out looking like a thug. According to the reports, after he got working, this guy went to the security cam setup, tore up the recording device, and made off with the disk drive medium. Michaels considered that for a few seconds.
So he was not so stoned he couldn't think about covering his ass.
Maybe. Or maybe there was something on the disk he wanted, though it probably wasn't him. According to the complaint, all the people involved swear they would have remembered this guy if he'd ever been in their place. Guy was built like a toothpick. That he was the proverbial 97-pound weakling made his rampage all that much more amazing. The bodybuilders couldn't believe it. Gotta be our friend Mr. Purple Cap responsible.
So what good does this do us?
Well, we know that three of the dealer's customers live in or around L.A. I'm thinking maybe our dealer might like the sunny lifestyle. The shelf life of this mojo drug is pretty short. It rots in a day or so. And for the Z-ster to get stuff himself, then to the rich girl, and for her to have time enough to use it, I'm thinking maybe the guy who supplied Ziegler is not halfway around the world. FedEx or even a paid courier are limited by the speed of a jet. The further away he is, the narrower the window and the drug will still work.
Michaels nodded. Okay. So, hypothetically speaking, maybe he lives within spitting distance of SoCal. Does that help as much?
Narrows down the search. I can start checking chemical companies, drug supply houses, running lists of convicted dealers like that. And maybe the cops will turn up something on the late Mr. Ziegler's travels.
Jay took a long swallow of the club soda.
Anything new on the drug itself? How did that cap assay out?
Michaels frowned. Crap. He'd tucked the thing into his pocket and forgotten about it. Those trousers were in a heap on the floor in his closet.
Boss?
I haven't had a chance to get by the lab yet.
I got the DEA's breakdown of what ingredients they could find. I'll use those for a starting point. If the guy is smart, he'll buy his chem for cash and far away from home, but you never know. Sometimes it's the little things that trip you up.
Well, do what you can, Jay. Keep me in the loop.
Sure thing, boss.
Newport Beach, California. Drain came away from the funeral experience pretty depressed. He got out of there as soon as he could. His old man was busy, taking charge, and they didn't really have much to say to each other, Drain and his old man. They never really had. The old man had never thought much of his only son, never seemed interested in what he did, always expected perfection. He brought home a report card with 5 A's and a B. The old man didn't say, "Hey, good job, congratulations." No, he said, "Why the B? You need to apply yourself more." No, they had not gotten along for as long as he could remember, his old man and him. And yet he felt some kind of perverse need to demonstrate to his father that he was competent, which was kind of hard to do when what you were most competent at was mixing and selling illegal drugs, and your old man was a pillar of law enforcement who put people like you away. The drive back to Malibu was bright and sunny. He hadn't seen Tad last night or this morning, and he suspected that was because Tad had taken another hammer trip, even though Drain had told him not to. The hammer was Tad's reason to get up in the morning. Thor was the ultimate party friend, the guy Tad had been looking for all his life. And Thor would be the guy who'd kill him, too. Then again, in his own way, Tad was fairly reliable. If he had swallowed the cap and gone hyper, it had probably been after he had done the job Drain had sent him to do. He didn't really know why Tad was so important to him. They had run into each other doing biz, and something about the reedy guy in black had tickled Drain. Nothing sexual, they were into women, though Tad preferred drugs to pussy mostly. And not as if Tad were some kind of sparkling conversationalist. But he was loyal, and he did think Drain was a genius, and he got the job done. If he wanted to go out in a blaze of Dionysian glory, that was his right. Tad was pretty much the only friend Drain had. Making and dealing illegal chem didn't open you up to a whole lot of deep relationships with honest people. When Tad croaked, that was going to leave a big hole in the list of people Drain could relax around. Of course, he had enough money now that if he invested it right, he could almost live off the interest. Another year or so of 1,000-buck-a-hit sales, he'd be set. Then he could retire, make some friends who started out thinking he was a dot-com millionaire or had made a killing in the market or something, who'd take him at face value, live his life out in the open, perfectly legal, no looking over his shoulder. That made him grin. Yeah, he could do that. Would he? Not an ice cube's chance in a supernova, he would.
because it wasn't just the money, it was the game. The ability to do what he did, to do it better than anybody else, and to get away with it. Hell, if he wanted to, he could take his formulas to the legitimate drug companies and they'd fall all over themselves to shovel money at him. Got a patient with muscle wasting who was bedbound and on the way down? What would it be worth to him to enjoy some mobility in his final days? You about to take the GRE to get into graduate school? What would adding 15 points to your IQ for a couple hours be worth? Stuff Drain worked with could do that and more. Drain could have gone to work for those guys a long time ago, but there wasn't any challenge there, not to be straight, not to be like his father. He sighed. He was smart enough to know he was a little fucked up when it came to such things. Had done some reading in psychology. But he was what he was, and devil take the reasons. Jesus, he was tight, wound up like a spring. Maybe he should stop at the gym on the way home, loosen up a little. Yeah, maybe he'd do that. It would be relaxing. Malibu, California. Drain couldn't remember the last time he had been so pissed off. He pounded the steering wheel of the Mercedes hard enough to crack it, and he wished it was fucking Tad's head. Jesus Christ! By the time he got home, however, he had calmed down somewhat. He was almost detached, almost fatalistic about it when he pulled into the garage. He had always known this was a possibility, though he hadn't expected it would ever really happen. He was too smart to be caught by the plotters. He'd been giving them fucking clues and they couldn't do it. Only Tad wasn't, and the boy had stepped in it good this time. Tad was out cold on the couch, and even the pitcher full of ice water hardly roused him. Drain started slapping his face. Eventually, Tad came awake, sort of.
What?
You idiot!
What?
The gym! You trashed the gym! I stopped by there to work out, and that was all anybody was talking about. Even if I hadn't sent you, I could recognize you from their descriptions, you moron!
Groggy, Tad sat up.
I'm all wet.
You got that right, Tad.
I don't understand, Bobby. I got the disc from the security drive. The job's done. We're free and clear. Nobody has anything to link us to Ziegler. There's no proof of anything.
You really don't see it, do you?
Drain sat heavily on the couch next to his partner. Of a moment, he felt sorry for Tad. He kept forgetting most people didn't have his horsepower when it came to cranking up the mental engines.
Obviously, the smart drugs hadn't kicked in when you decided to feel up Atlas's sister. Think about it.
Tad shook his head, still not tracking.
Look, I know you're tired and stoned, and ordinarily I'd let you sleep it off, but time just got to be a problem. You made a mistake.
I don't see it. They don't know who I am. No way.
Drain looked at Tad, who made death warmed over seem the picture of health, and realized he had to take it slow for him to keep up with it.
See if you can stay with me here. The police and the feds will know you were on the hammer, because nothing else can explain a burned-out matchstick like you kicking major steroid ass like you did. And the bust at Ziegler's was a major deal and on the minds of the cops. And if they dig just a little, they'll come up with the Z-ster working out of Steve's, and zap, a light will flash over their heads, and they'll think, big movie star shoots it out with the DEA, and they find this super guy drug in his house. Then within a real short time, somebody trashes a gym where the big movie star works out, obviously on the same super guy drug. Say, isn't that a funny coincidence? And somebody in the FBI or the local police, they are going to ask themselves the big question, why? Why the guy... That's you. Why did the guy come in and steal the security cam's recording device? And they are going to come up with, hey, maybe there is something on that disc the guy doesn't want us to see. What could it be? And somebody is going to take it one step further, since they know the Z-ster worked out there, and that somebody is going to say, maybe because the big movie star was there with somebody who really doesn't want to be seen.
But the recording is gone,
so it is. But the people who work there aren't. I know Steve, the owner, and he might remember that a couple of times when Ziegler was there, he and I came or went together. And if Steve or Tom or Dick or Harry or anybody else in the place remembers that, then my name is going to come up in a conversation with the feds or cops. And even if Steve doesn't remember, the cops will get a list of members and go looking for a connection. This is a cop lesson I learned at my daddy's knee. When you don't have anything, you check everything. And sooner or later, they're going to send somebody out to talk to folks on the list, just routine, and there will be a knock on our door. And I have a nice, made-up job that, fortunately, I didn't mention on my application at the gym, one that's all nice and electronically vouched for, so maybe they can poke at it a little and it might even hold up, but what is the fucking job, Tad? Oh, shit. Oh, shit, yeah, I am a chemist. Think that'll, you know, raise any red flags or ring any bells? Illicit drugs and a chemist? There are millions of test tube jockeys in the world, but how many of us working out at the same gym as the dead guy they are investigating? Even the stupidest cop alive could run with that one. The feds might not be the fastest mill wheels in the world, but they grind exceedingly fine. They are plodders, but that's what they do best. And if they get this far, we are fucked. Even if the house is as clean as a wetware assembly room, if they can't prove anything, they'll know who I am. And I won't be able to go pee from now on without seeing an underwater camera lens in the toilet bowl looking up at me.
Tad shook his head. I'm sorry, man.
I know, Tad, I know, and it's done. Now we have to see if we can manage some kind of damage control.
How?
You know the guy in Texas, down in Austin?
The programmer who buys two caps every 3 or 4 weeks for him and his girlfriend.
Yeah, him. I read about him in Time. He's supposed to be a genius.
So
we make him a deal. He does us a favor, we supply him with whatever rings his bell for free.
Dude is richer than Midas. He doesn't need the money.
But I know how geniuses think, Train said, especially outlaw geniuses. He'll do it so we'll owe him, and in the doing, he can prove he's still got the chops he started out with. He gets to feel like a badass outlaw again.
What is he going to do that'll help?
He's going to make us invisible. Get a hold of him.
No.
Right now.
Washington, D.C. Tony tried doing her jurus while sitting on the couch, just using her upper body, as Guru had told her. Yeah, she could do it, but it was like taking a shower with a raincoat on. She stood, moved the coffee table out of the way, and did a little stretching. Nothing major, just to limber up her back and hips some. The doctor hadn't said she couldn't stretch, just nothing heavy duty, right? After 5 minutes or so of loosening up, she felt better. Okay, so she could do a few jurus with the footwork. The Lankas, if she went real slow, right? No sudden moves, no real effort. It wouldn't be any more stressful than walking if she was careful, right? For about 10 minutes, she practiced, moving slowly. She skipped the forms where she had to drop into a squat, and she felt fine. Then, of course, she had to go pee. When she finished, she looked into the toilet. The bowl had blood in it. Fear grabbed her in an icy hand. Oh, no. She ran to call the doctor.
Austin, Texas. Tad drove the rental car, Bobby riding shotgun and giving him directions.
I don't see why we had to come here in person, Tad said. We could have called or done this by email.
No, we couldn't have. The feds can monitor phones and email. Besides, this guy wants an insurance policy. He wants to see our faces. He'll know the name, and he can use that, but we could change our identities.
We could change our faces, too.
Yeah, we could, but as long as we're in business, he'll have something on us. Doesn't matter what our names are or what we look like. We have the market cornered on Thor's hammer, remember? Whoever is selling it is going to be us, no matter what we call ourselves.
Yeah, I have to say, though, this might be out of the frying pan and into the fire, man. Even if it works, we're trading one problem for another.
I don't think so, Bobby said.
The guy will have something to trade if he ever gets busted. You think he wouldn't give us up to save his own ass?
Don't think that for a second. I'd give him up if positions were reversed.
Geez, Bobby.
Come on, Tad. Think a little past the end of your nose. The clock is running at the cop shop. This computer dickwad can get into the gym's computer in the police system and make my name go away. He does that before they get to me, we're clear.
If the cops didn't just get a hard copy.
They didn't. Steve told me they downloaded his membership files into their system over the wire. Nobody uses hard copy for this kind of stuff anymore. So the immediate threat, the law, is taken care of. Mr. Computer Geek is a potential problem, but that's down the line. He isn't going to run to the cops and turn us in now. Not if he wants help from Mighty Thor with his lady friend. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but...
You know about Occam's razor?
No.
It's a way of looking at problems. A rule that basically says, don't get complicated when simple will do the job. The simple thing here is, if the cops don't know about me, they can't come looking for me.
Okay, I can see that. You buy some time, but you still got the potential thing later.
Well, if you just let it hang out there, yeah, but this computer guy could, you know, have an accident, and that would be the end of it, right? Bobby grinned. Tad got it, finally.
Oh, yeah. I see what you mean.
There's hope for you yet, Tad, my boy. Washington, D.C. Jay sat Seiza and tried to make himself one with everything. He was having some problems with it. While he was supposed to be concentrating on his breath, just sitting back and watching it come and go without trying to control it or count it or anything, that was almost impossible to pull off. As soon as he became aware of his breathing, he kept trying to slow it, and counting just came naturally for him. It was automatic. So he had to make a conscious effort not to count, and that was a no-no. Don't count, and don't think about not counting. You weren't supposed to think of anything at all. That last inhalation turned into a sigh at the end. Get a grip, Jay. Millions of people do this every day. Who knew that meditating would be so difficult? Sitting here and doing nothing was harder than anything Jay had ever done, or, in this case, not done. In the back of his mind, nagging at him, was something about work, something he couldn't quite pin down, something about the drug thing and the DEA and NSA agents Lee and George. No, push it away. Lee and George. Not much to know about them. Both lived in the district, both of them married briefly but divorced. No live-in girlfriends at the moment. A lot alike. Lee's ex-wife was now a lawyer in Atlanta who also taught law at a local college, and while she was well-regarded as a teacher, she was also considered something of a radical. She was a member of the Lesbian Teacher Association or some such, big on women's rights. A no-fault divorce, no hard feelings, at least not in any official records or interviews. Still, that must have made Lee feel weird. You get a divorce, your ex-wife switches her sexual preferences to the other side of the street. Might tend to make you doubt your masculinity a little. George's ex was a stockbroker, a law school graduate who didn't practice, single, no significant boyfriends after the divorce, didn't seem to date much. Like Lee with his ex-wife, George apparently got along famously with his ex. We're all very civilized here. Thoughts, Jay. Watch it. Okay. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in. The next thought so startled him that his eyes popped open and he said, oh, shit! Sitting Seiza on the floor across from him, Saji came out of her own meditation. What? The place on fire? No, I just had a thought. Don't worry, it's part of the process. No, I mean an idea about the dope case. It will keep... No, it won't. I have to get to my computer now. Saji sighed. Fine, do what you have to do. She closed her eyes and went back to her sitting. Jay was already up and hurrying from the bedroom to his terminal. Michaels took the day off to be with Tony. She was still in bed, sleeping hard, and he planned to let her sleep as long as possible. The spotting the day before wasn't a sign of fetal distress, the doctor had told them. By the time he had gotten to the clinic, Tony had already been examined, was getting some blood tests, and the doctor had pulled him aside to talk to him. The doctor, the tall, spindly, gray-haired man of 60 or so, was blunt. Listen, Mr. Michaels, if your wife doesn't sit down and prop her feet up and do a lot of nothing for the next 4 months, there is a chance she is going to have a preterm birth and lose this baby.
Jesus, have you told her this?
I have. Michael swallowed.
Tony is the toughest, strongest, healthiest woman I know.
The doctor smiled. Yes, I expect she can bend steel in her bare hands, but interior plumbing isn't the same as voluntary muscles. No matter how strong-willed you might be, you can't toughen up the inside of a uterus. Tony's is fragile. You need to impress on her how important it is for her to relax. After the baby comes, she can go swing on a vine like Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, and kick the crap out of lions and rhinos for all I care. But for now, no strenuous exercise. What I think is strenuous and what she thinks that means are probably different. I don't want her doing those martial art dances she can't seem to live without. She can lie in bed. She can sit in a chair or on a couch. She can walk to the kitchen to take her vitamins, but that's about it.
Michaels nodded. I understand.
If we have another episode of second trimester bleeding, I am going to confine her to bed for the duration. I know she won't like that.
Michaels had to grin. No, sir, that's for sure.
Now, Tony slept and Michaels puttered around the condo. In the living room, he came across the box with the two karambit knives. He took them out, put one in each hand, got a feel for how they worked. Odd to be playing with knives and thinking about a new baby. Well, maybe not, given the boy's parents. He moved the knives slowly and carefully. The little blade seemed familiar in his grip, comfortable, and the juru moves didn't seem to put him in any danger of cutting himself, at least not this slow and careful. One hurried wrong move could put the lie to that quick enough, though. Somewhere over New Mexico. On the flight home, Drain felt pretty good. The computer guy was as good as he'd been cracked up to be. The police in SoCal and Steve's gym no longer had any reference to one Robert Drain in their systems. More, the techno-whiz was able to determine that they hadn't gotten around to where his name had been assigned to anybody to check it before it had been magically vanished, nor had it been printed out. The list had been renumbered, and unless you knew somebody had been erased and knew precisely where to look and how to look, you wouldn't be able to tell it had been done. And even if you could tell that, you wouldn't know who was gone. Once again, Drain was golden, and all it had cost was a promise of free dope as long as the guy lived. Cheap beyond measure, even if he had to pay it. Drain smiled as the flight attendant walked along the first-class rows, asking if anybody wanted complimentary champagne. Drain glanced at his watch. About now, Tad would be buying the computer whiz a dinner at a great little out-of-the-way Italian restaurant locally famous for its fresh produce. The computer geek, a health nut, had raved about the place. The salad that came with the meal featured fresh wild greens, mushrooms, and other local herbs, and was terrific, he'd said. Drain had smiled, regretting that he had to be back in L.A. and would have to miss that, but hey, Tad loved salad. The last time Tad had eaten a salad, or anything remotely healthy, had probably been 20 years past, but Mr. Computer Wizard had chosen his own exit. If everything went as planned, just as the computer geek was about to lay into his garden delight, he was going to get a call on his comm. Tad had the number programmed into his own comm, and a touch of a button would do the trick. While Mr. Wizard was distracted, Tad was going to add a couple of different kinds of sliced mushrooms to the man's salad that weren't on the menu. These grew wild in places as hot and damp as Austin still was this time of year. Easy to find if you knew where to look. Mr. Computer Wizard would enjoy his meal. He and Tad would part company on the best of terms. A day later, maybe two, Mr. Wizard would come down with flu-like symptoms. His doctor would probably miss the diagnosis at first, but even if he didn't, the only way to keep the victim alive would be a liver and maybe a kidney transplant, and even then the heart was still at risk. No guarantee, of course, but 8 chances out of 10 he would croak weren't bad odds. And if he made it, well, they could always pay him another visit. And if he died, it would be due to mushroom poisoning, a terrible tragedy, a freak accident. Bad for the restaurant's reputation and insurance carrier, but hey, that was how life went sometimes. The flight attendant approached.
Care for champagne, sir? That would be nice. Look, I don't want you to think I'm hitting on you, but
I'm a movie producer. Have you ever considered acting?
He held up his producer business card and smiled. She took the card, looked at it, and smiled back.
I've thought about it. I was the lead in my high school play.
Life was very good.
Life was crappy, Tony thought.
Alex had hung around to take care of her, but she had made him leave.
You sure?
He'd asked after three exchanges on the subject.
I'm positive. Go.
And he had. And that pissed her off, too.
Yes, all right, she knew it was illogical, but that was how she felt.
Now that Alex was gone, she was at a loss for what to do with herself. She didn't feel like sitting at the Scrimshaw Project. She didn't feel like watching television or listening to music or reading. The house was clean. You could eat off the floor if you were allowed to bend over and take the risk. She wandered into the bedroom. The floor in Alex's closet had some clothes piled up to be dry cleaned. Well, she could do that. She picked up a suit, a sports jacket, a couple of good silk shirts. The laundry to-go basket was in the garage, where Alex would usually notice it when it got full. As she started dropping the clothes into the hamper, she automatically went through the pockets. Being raised in a family full of brothers had taught her that when doing the wash. Boys left all kinds of crap in their pockets. Ink pens could ruin a load of whites. In the suit trousers, Tony found a paperclip box, and inside that, the capsule. She knew what it was from Alex's description, it being big and purple and all. She reached for the phone on the workbench. Alex's comm bleeped.
Hey, babe, what's up? You okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. I was taking your dry cleaning out to the hamper. I found this purple capsule in your pocket.
Ah, damn, I keep forgetting about that. I was going to take it by the FBI lab and have somebody look at it. That's the one John got on the raid I told you about. Hang on to it for me. I'll do it tomorrow.
Jay shook his head, feeling stupid. It had been right there in front of him all along, and he had just skipped over it. Maybe all this navel-gazing was good in the long run, but the old Jay Gridley wouldn't have let this slide past unseen. Jesus. He needed to fly it past the boss to get his hit on it, but he was pretty sure it meant something important. He reached for the comm to call, then decided maybe it would be better to avoid using the phone or net.
I have to go into HQ, Jay said to Saji on his way to the door.
This late? She opened her eyes and stared at him, still seated in her meditation pose.
It's important. I love you. See you later.
Drive safe.
Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. Tad sat at the gate, slouched in a chair, waiting for his connecting flight back to LAX. Even full of painkillers, speed, and steroids to the eyeballs, it was all he could do to hold himself up. Every muscle, every joint, every part of him he could feel ached, a bone-deep, grinding throb that resonated through him with every heartbeat. He was so tired he could hardly see straight. But his fuck-up was fixed, and yeah, okay, he'd had to ice some poor sucker to wrap it. At least Bobby wasn't pissed at him anymore. He hated to disappoint Bobby, who put up with a lot of his crap without kicking him out. Only friend he'd ever had, Tad knew, and the only person on Earth who had ever given a shit about him. He just didn't let people like that down. He planned to crash when he got back to Malibu and sleep for a week. Maybe by then he would have recovered enough to pick up the hammer again. Now that everything was copacetic with Bobby, there was no need to fly to Hawaii or even slow down biz. Life was normal again, such as normal was, and he could get back on the road to hell as soon as he was able. Quantico, Virginia. Jay was almost hopping up and down. Michael smiled.
Okay, tell me. You caught our dope dealer?
Jay frowned, as if that thought was the last thing on his mind.
What? Oh, no. If we were doing a movie, that would be the A story. What I did is figure out the B story. Well, at least part of it. I was all over the DEA guy Lee and the NSA agent George. Nothing. No connection. but I expanded the search and I came up with Lynn Davis Lee and Jackie McNally George.
Who are?
The ex-wives. Lee and George met their wives in law school, got hitched, went their separate ways a couple years later. Both are divorced.
So am I, Jay. So was roughly 50% of everybody who got married in the last 20 years.
The younger man grinned. Yeah, but Lynn Davis and Jackie McNally were roommates in law school.
Really? That is an odd coincidence.
It gets better, boss. Lynn Davis, she dropped her married name after the split, is a lawyer and part-time teacher in Atlanta. From what I was able to determine, she, prefers the company of women to men.
How shocking. So?
Same deal with Jackie McNally. She is also a lesbian.
Hmm.
Yeah, you see where I'm going here? Doesn't that seem, well, queer, that two guys married and then divorced college roommates, both of whom are lesbians?
It also doesn't prove anything, does it?
Nope. But what if Ms. Davis and Ms. McNally had the same sexual preferences before they got married? From what I can tell, that was the case.
Michaels chewed on that for a moment.
Ah, he said, beginning to understand. It makes sense, Jay said. There are a lot of places where, laws notwithstanding, being gay is still a problem. Federal agencies aren't allowed to discriminate about such things, but you know how it is. Come out as gay, you put a glass ceiling over your own head.
Michaels nodded. That was true, like it or not, especially in security agencies. The theory was an openly gay operative wouldn't be a problem, but somebody in the closet might be a candidate for blackmail if he or she didn't want to be outed. And he had a pretty good idea of where Jay was going with the rest of it. But he didn't say anything, just waved for him to keep rolling.
So, consider this scenario. Lee and George are, well, let's say, men's men. They know that being that way is likely to top them out at a low level in a lot of agencies. And lesbians have the same problems.
So you think we have a case of two gay men marrying two lesbian women to provide each other with solid heterosexual backgrounds?
It wouldn't be the first time. Having an ex-wife or husband on paper would forestall some tongue-wagging, especially if you were discreet from then on. Only now, Lee and George, who maybe aren't so close anymore, really don't like each other. Might explain some things.
Michaels nodded again.
That could be. You did good, Jay. Thanks.
After Jay was gone, Michaels thought about it some, then reached for the comm. He wanted to talk to John Howard. An ugly idea had just entered his mind, and while he hoped things wouldn't go down that road, he had to check it out.
Howard nodded at Michaels. He'd been figuratively shuffling paperclips when the commander called.
No doubt in your mind?
No, sir. Lee flat assassinated the man. Ziegler was clearly about to drop his knife. Plus, my radio mic was still on. Lee heard Ziegler say he was surrendering. No, sir. This guy was a DEA field agent for years. He went on scores of raids. When he pulled the trigger, he had to know the situation was under control.
That brings up a big question, doesn't it?
Yes, sir. Why would he do that?
Any theories you want to share?
Assuming there was no personal hatred of the man, the only thing I can come up with is that he didn't want Ziegler giving up his dealer.
That doesn't make any sense, because the whole purpose of the raid was so we could find that out.
Yes, sir. Ziegler was about to spill his guts when Lee double-tapped him. Michael shook his head.
I don't like this worth a damn, John. Something stinks here.
I do believe so myself. The commander leaned back in his chair.
If it had just been Lee there, he could claim he shot Ziegler to save the maid.
Who speaks about five words of English and was so terrified she didn't know which way was up, Howard added. Not a great witness either way.
So come the shooting review, or whatever it is DEA does, anything you have to say is going to make Lee look real bad. He had to know what he did was going to cost him big time.
If they believe me, it ought to be worth his job. Maybe he thinks he can blow enough smoke to get past it.
I wouldn't underrate yourself, John. You are the military commander of Net Force, a general. You can shine a lot of light on him.
Yes, sir. So we're back to the big question. What did he have to gain that was so important he'd risk his job?
I certainly think we need to find out.
Yes, sir.
There's one other thing we need to think about here, too, John.
Sir?
Maybe Lee loves his job and is willing to do anything to keep it.
Bit of a stretch, isn't it?
He killed a world-famous movie star in front of a witness who, at the very least, can get him fired and maybe charged with a nasty felony. Maybe if something happened to the witness, he might not be so worried.
Howard nodded. I take your point. I'll make sure my brakes are working before I go for a drive.
And make sure nothing is attached to the ignition switch, too, John. I'd hate to have to break in a new military commander.
Yes, sir. I'd hate to put you to the trouble. Los Angeles, California. Drain was not a man to make the same mistake twice, especially on something that could cost him his freedom. As soon as he was back on the ground in L.A., still in the car on the way home, he made a call to a real estate agent. He got her name out of the phone directory and picked it because he liked the sound of it.
Silverman Realty, the woman said. This is Shawanda speaking.
Shawanda Silverman. What kind of intermarriage produced such a great name? He loved it.
Yes, ma'am, my name is Laszlo Mead, and I'm going to be living here in the Los Angeles area for about a year or so. Yes, Mr. Mead? What I want is to lease a 3- or 4-bedroom furnished house, maybe out a little ways in one of the canyons.
Certainly I can help you with that. What price range are we talking about?
Well, the company is paying for it, so maybe you could find one where the rent was somewhere around $8,000 to $10,000 a month.
He could hear the cash register in her voice.
No problem with that. I can make a list of a few places, and we can get together and view them. Well, here's the thing. I'm kind of in a hurry, but I'm up to my eyeballs in work. Maybe you could just, you know, pick a place that would work for me and my wife and just go ahead and lease it for us. I'll email you a transfer, first month, last month, cleaning and security fees, whatever, say $40,000, and e-sign any paperwork to get the ball rolling. We can get together later.
I'm sure I can find a house that will work for you. Any preferences as to furniture or schools or such?
Well, my wife likes modern stuff. No kids, so schools don't matter. I'll email you pictures. That would be good.
He gave her one of the remailing addresses he used. She probably already had caller ID'd the number of the clean phone he kept for just such transactions, the one made out in the name of Projects, Inc. Now, there was a term that could be stretched to fit virtually anything. After he broke the connection, he felt a lot better. In a day or two, he'd have a hideout, so if he had to leave the Malibu house in a hurry, there would be a place he could run to where he could sort things out. He had a big, fat, 500-pound gun safe bolted to the concrete floor in a U-Storit place way out Ventura Boulevard. He'd drive over the hill and move most of the cash from the beach house to that, tonight, as a matter of fact. With his money safe and a place to hide, he would be halfway ready. Laszlo Mead was about to come into full existence, too. Drain had a wonderful illegal software program and card stocks for making phony IDs. The program would also print out pictures of a mythical wife and parents if he wanted. That would take care of the basics. When Tad got home, he could do the other part, the hired muscle. A few armed bodyguards could buy them enough time to haul ass if somebody came calling, especially if Drain gave them the right story. "Somebody yells police? They are lying," he'd tell the shooters. "It's guys trying to rip us off." Tad knew people who'd shoot it out with cops if the pay was rich enough. Maybe he ought to get a gun, too. He'd never had much use for those, but after the Zeister bought it, the thought had popped up. Of course, all this would tap into his money pretty good, $40,000 for the house, probably 50 or 60 more for 5 bodyguards, but it had to be done. He'd been lax before, but not anymore. It had been a big game, really, but when customers started getting cooked by feds, the seriousness factor went way up. He hadn't really believed he'd ever be caught, and the idea of spending years in a federal prison somewhere fending off some big horny con named Bubba did not appeal at all. So it would cost. Big deal. Money was the easiest part. If he put the word out, he could move 50 or 60 hits of the hammer a week. Easy. A couple 3 months of doing that every week or two, he'd make expenses and a whole lot more. Clear, say, $500,000 in the next few months, then take a break? The office comm number went off. He frowned at it. Saw there was no caller ID sig lit. He knew who it had to be.
Polymers, Drain.
Robert, this is your father.
Jesus, didn't the old man think he could recognize his fucking voice after all these years?
Hey, Dad, what's up?
I'm leaving your aunt's to go back to Arizona tomorrow. I thought we might get together for breakfast before I go.
Drain felt a cold finger along his spine. His father wanted to see him? That was very strange.
Sure. I know a couple of places near Edna's that are pretty good.
Give me the name and I'll get directions from Edna.
Sure.
We'll meet at 7 a.m.,
his father said. It was not a question. Tony, feeling better after an afternoon mostly spent sleeping, listened to Alex's day.
So that's what we've got on our friends at the DEA and NSA, he finished. What do you think?
Well, on the face of it, Lee wouldn't have any particular reason to want Ziegler dead for any kind of personal vendetta, so what's the personal gain?
I don't see any.
You remember those calls he got offering you work with the pharmaceutical companies? He chuckled.
Yeah.
Well, from what you said, there seems to be a lot of interest in this drug. We're talking about big money. Maybe somebody convinced Mr. Lee he could cash in big time if he got the dealer and delivered him, or his formula, to the right party. He wouldn't want NetForce getting to the guy first, so he wouldn't want John to know the dealer's name, right? He stared at her.
Wow.
Don't you dare sound so surprised, Alex Michaels. My mind does still work. You'll find the dealer. I have great faith in you.
You'd be the only one.
How many do you need? He smiled.
Why, ma'am, I do believe one will be just exactly enough.
Quantico, Virginia. Howard was tired of sitting around. He was itchy to do something.
Love to see a man hard at work.
Howard looked up and saw Julio standing in the doorway of his office.
Lieutenant Fernandez, what brings you here?
I believe that would be my size 11 combat boots, sir.
And is there a purpose for this visit?
Why, good news, General Howard, sir.
Come on in, then. I can use some news.
I think you're going to like this.
Howard looked at the flat black hard case Julio held. It was about 3 feet long, half that wide.
You have my attention, Lieutenant.
Sir, you might recall the 1,000-meter special teams match for United States Military Services held at Camp Perry every November?
Oh, I recall, all right. That would be the match where NetForce's sharpshooters always come in last place, behind the Marines, the Army, and even the Navy.
Only because you won't order Gunny to enter. He'd beat him.
Howard nodded at the case.
This a secret weapon?
Well, a weapon, yes, but not so secret. Just new. Take a look.
Julio set the case down on the old map table across from Howard's desk, popped the latches on the case, and clamshelled it open. Howard walked over and looked.
Why, it is a gun. It appears to be a bolt-action 50 BMG rifle.
Yes, sir, but not just any 5.0. This is a prototype, one of only two built, of the upcoming EMD Arms Model XM-109A Windrunner, designed by Bill Ritchie himself, third generation.
You have to go looking for your shoulder after you fire it?
No, sir. It kicks about as hard as a stout 12-gauge.
I bet.
You'll notice the M14 bipod and mounted scope, the latter of which is sighted in for 1,000 meters. And there is a nifty little red dot switch. Short range, put the dot on the target. That's where the bullet goes.
A nice toy, Howard allowed. How much?
These things are like hen's teeth, sir. The waiting list is a mile long. And how can you put a price on this kind of quality?
He stroked the barrel with one hand.
There are only two of them exactly like this in all the world.
Let's try, shall we? How much?
Well, with our discount, a hair over $5,000 each.
That actually sounds pretty reasonable.
Then, knowing Julio for all the years he'd known him, he said,
A hair over, you said? How thick a hair are we talking about?
Call it 3,000 and change,
Julio grinned.
What? For $8,000, this beast had better dance and whistle Dixie, Lieutenant.
Well, I wouldn't know about that, sir, but EDM Arms guarantees 1 minute of angle accuracy at 1,000 meters right out of the box.
Howard raised his eyebrows at that.
One MOA? Guaranteed?
Just as you see it. I thought that would get your attention, but that's only to keep the lawyers happy. EDM Arms has got verified 5-round groups at 1,000 meters of 0.5 MOA. They say they got a couple groups that good at 1,700 meters, even a little longer.
Howard looked at the weapon again.
Good Lord, that's a tack driver.
Yes, sir. And Bowens, our newly recruited ex-Army shooter, has been doing just that with this very piece starting yesterday. Talking about a pie plate-sized group from a mile away.
He didn't want to let me take it long enough to show it to you.
Howard grinned.
So, come next month, Net Force's little piece of the National Guard is going to shoot the living asses off the Navy, the Marines, and the Army.
If one of them doesn't get his hands on the other one. Julio grinned real big. You didn't. Howard shook his head. I'll have to beat the budget to cover this.
Not the way I figure it. We do it right, we can make our costs on side bets. I can get 3-1 against us easy. I wouldn't be surprised to make even a small profit.
They both grinned at that.
Anyway, I thought you might like to take it to the outdoor range and put a few through it. That is, if you aren't too busy here.
He looked around. You missed your calling, Lieutenant. You should have been a comedian.
Yes, sir. I believe I could have sparkled in such a profession.
Howard looked at the weapon. Why not? He didn't have anything better to do. You coming along?
No, sir. I have diaper duty starting in... He looked at his watch. 46 minutes. Best I not be late.
Howard chuckled. No, I understand. It has been a while since I had such duty myself, but one cannot stress the importance of it enough.
If one's wife is Lieutenant Joanna Winthrop Fernandez, one can sure as hell stress it high, wide, and repeatedly.
Washington, D.C. Tony felt terrific. She and Alex had a great night together, and when she awakened this morning, she'd been rested and refreshed. After Alex left for work, she decided to work on her scrimshaw. At the bench, she turned on the gooseneck lamp and was about to get started when she saw the purple capsule lying there. She put the cap on the table in her work field and adjusted the lamp to shine on it, focused the stereoscope on it. Maybe something inside was more interesting. If she opened it very carefully...
Shit!
She said, as the powder, which was a kind of bubblegum pink, spilled all over the table. She dropped the halves of the cap and grabbed a little paintbrush she used for dusting the ivory. She swept the pink powder into a little pile, then onto a sheet of paper. As she picked up the larger of the now mostly empty capsule segments to reload the powder, she noticed an odd strip of coloration on one end, just inside the edge. She held the cap under the scope, couldn't quite make it out. She put the cap down, removed the auxiliary lens, and brought the scope's magnification to 10x. Let's have another look, shall we? Jesus, what was that? She fiddled with the light, turned the cap this way, then that, so she could make it out. Etched into the material of the cap were tiny words.
Hi, Phoebes. Want to find me? Ask Frankie and Annette's grandkids. They know where. Sincerely yours, Thor.
Hello. She reached for the phone on the end of the bench. Alex was going to want to hear about this. Newport Beach, California. The restaurant was half a block off the highway and slightly up the hill, so it had a nice view of the water. Drain's father sat alone in a booth, staring out through a wall of glass at the Pacific, the waters already changing from gray to blue as the sun began to burn off the morning fog.
Hello, Dad.
Robert.
Drain slid into the booth.
What's up?
Let's order first.
The waitress came by. When she was gone to put their order in, his father cleared his throat.
I'm glad your mother isn't alive to see what you've become.
Drain stared at him.
What?
How stupid do you think I am, Robert? Polychem products.
Drain felt his belly spasm.
What about them?
His father looked disgusted.
There is no them. It's a paper corporation, a phantom. You are Polychem products.
Drain couldn't think of anything to say. He was cold. He'd never expected this. The old man looked out at the ocean again.
I have friends, boy. People who owe me favors. I know where you live, and I know you live well, but I also know that you don't have any visible way of earning money. So that means you are into something illegal or immoral, probably both. From the way you talked about admiring that criminal who assaulted the agents and staff at HQ recently, I surmise it probably has something to do with drugs.
Dad? His old man turned back to face him, held up his hand to silence him, and in that moment he was Special Agent in Charge Rickover Drain of old, steely-eyed and fierce, one of the most stalwart protectors of the Republic.
Don't say anything. I don't want to know about it. I expected better of you, that's all.
Drain lost it.
You expected me to turn into a fucking robot without feelings.
You wanted a carbon copy of yourself, a grown-up Boy Scout who was trustworthy, loyal, friendly, obedient, who would cog his way into the system and stay there smiling until he wore out, just like you. You never once asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, or cared what I thought about anything.
The old man blinked.
I wanted the best for you.
Your best? What you thought I should be? You were always too busy saving the country from the forces of evil to give a shit what I did, as long as I kept my grades up and I didn't bother you.
Robert.
Jesus fucking Christ, listen to yourself. Everybody in the world calls me Bobby except for you. I asked you to do that 100 times. You didn't listen. You never listened.
Nobody said anything for a long time.
So, what are you going to do? Give my name to your friends?
The old man shook his head.
No.
No? Why? Because I'm your son and you love me? Or because you wouldn't want your old FBI chums to know your son was anything less than the soul of respectability?
You can think whatever you want. You're a brilliant man, son. Smarter than I ever was. You could have gone into legitimate business and made a fortune. You could have been somebody important.
What makes you think I can't do that now?
Oh, you could. I don't think you want to. You were always more interested in pulling my chain than anything else, weren't you?
And I still am, Drane was smart enough to realize. But he didn't want the old man to walk away from here with any kind of victory, so he said,
No. All I wanted was to get your attention. Any attention, good or bad, was better than indifference. That's what you gave me, Dad, indifference. So now you finally notice me enough to bust my balls. Thank you so fucking much. You want to turn me in for being a criminal? Go ahead. I don't care.
And if you do turn me in, I win, he thought. Drain stood, dropped a 50 on the table, and said,
I'm not hungry, but you enjoy your breakfast. Give my regards to the dog.
Drain turned and stalked off. Once he was in his car, he realized how shaken he was. He still cared what the old man thought of him. Amazing to realize that. Tad couldn't sleep. He was topped off with enough drugs, but his mind wouldn't go down. Bobby had told him about the safe house, moving the money, and wanting to hire some armed muscle. Tad had made some calls. Some guys were coming by to see Bobby later, shooters who didn't care who they cooked, long as the money was good. Tad went out on the deck, sprawled in the padded lounge chair. This is what his life had come to. There was the hammer, and then there was waiting for a chance to grab the hammer. That was it. Except for the waiting part, it was okay. NetForce HQ, Quantico, Virginia. Michaels said,
Mean anything to you?
Jay shook his head. Nope, not right off. But I've turned the search bots loose on it. I should be getting a first hit list any moment.
Where is John?
Ah, General.
Howard came into the conference room.
Sorry I'm late. I had to park in the secured lot. There's some, hardware I was checking out locked in the trunk of my car.
No problem. Do you recognize the names Frankie and Annette?
No, sir.
Michael slid a hard copy printout across the table to Howard. Howard shook his head.
And this came from where?
Michaels explained how Tony had discovered the hidden message inside the capsule. Jay said, Tell Tony that's nice work. Nothing in the DEA reports about this. Somebody there is maybe sitting on this information?
That's what I thought, Michaels said. I asked the director to pull some strings, and she's gotten the original lab reports from DEA. None of those have this little grandkid's riddle inscribed in them.
We think the DEA might be hiding things from us, Howard said.
Michaels nodded and brought him up to speed on what Jay had discovered.
And there's one more little tidbit, Jay said, when Michaels had finished. I have a record of a telecon between Hans Brocken and our Mr. Brett Lee of the DEA from 3 months back. Herr Brocken is the chief security officer for Brocken Pharmaceuticals of Berlin, Germany.
Howard said, You really think Lee is in bed with a drug company, looking to sell the formula for this stuff?
It makes a certain kind of sense, Michael said. We talked about reasons for him shooting the movie star before, remember?
And you think Lee is in league with the NSA?
Only with one particular person there. It seems that Mr. Lee and Mr. George have history about which they have not been entirely forthcoming.
though this is still circumstantial evidence.
I'll get harder stuff eventually. Oops, speaking of which, Jay tapped keys on his flat screen. Okay, here's what the Sherlock search bot has to say about my query. Jay frowned at the flat screen.
You want to let us in on it, Jay?
Oh, sorry. Jay tapped a key. The flat screen's vox began reading aloud.
Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello, teen singing and television idols from the late 1950s and early 1960s, first appeared together in the low-budget movie Beach Party, featuring musical roles by Dick Dale and the Deltones and Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys. The movie was the first of several in the chaste surf and sand genre. Avalon and Funicello were paired in several additional surf movies, including a distant sequel, Back to the Beach, 1987.
The computer's voice went silent, and the three men looked at each other.
Michaels said, "The stars of 50-year-old teeny bopper movies? Fine. Who were their grandchildren?"
Jay shook his head. "I'm cross-checking here, but it does not appear that the two had any off-screen relationship. They were both married to other people."
"Maybe we aren't talking about literal grandchildren, maybe movie grandchildren."
Jay tapped away at the keyboard.
"Nope. Nobody ever did another beach movie with the actors who played their children in the 87 picture."
"Maybe the message is speaking metaphorically," Howard said. "Anybody make any similar kind of pictures recently? Celluloid grandchildren, so to speak, of the originals?"
Jay smiled. "Well, film isn't made out of celluloid anymore, but that's pretty good, General. Let me see. Okay, here we are. Under beach movies, there are several..." I think I found it."
The flat screen's vox said, "Surf Days, an homage to the surf movies of the early 1960s, Fox Pictures 2004, starring Larry Wright, Mae Jean Kent, and George Harris Ziegler, set in Malibu in 1965.
"Stop," Michaels said. Jay paused the recitation.
"What?"
Howard beat Michaels to it.
"George Harris Ziegler."
Jay nodded.
"Oh, yeah, the Z-ster. This dope dealer is pulling our chain. We need to talk to the other actors."
"You gonna turn it over to the regular Phoebes?"
Michaels took a deep breath and let it out.
"No, I think maybe we ought to go check this out ourselves."
"Not in our charter," Howard said.
"The current waters are very murky," Michaels said. "Given the capabilities of the DEA and NSA, I'm not altogether sure just who we can trust. Sure, the FBI are our guys and they love us, but we can't cover any leaks on their part. We don't want to be behind the eight ball on this, do we?"
"No need to convince me, Commander," Howard said, smiling. "I'm going senile from boredom in my office. The drug raid was the most interesting thing that's happened in 3 months. I'm game."
"Me too," Jay said.
Howard went back and collected his staff car, then headed for home. He'd have time to pack a bag and tell Nadine goodbye. They'd be flying commercial. Commander Michaels did not want to attract any attention by cranking up one of the Net Force jets, and they'd be flying incognito. He headed out toward the freeway and the drive back to the city. Normally, the drive was a straight run up I-95 and into the district, loop around the belt and to the north end of town where he lived. But after a couple of miles, he spotted what he thought was a tail. A lot of people drove this stretch of road, and there were scores of cars and trucks heading in the same direction, so there was no way to be sure. But he had been through the standard Net Force surveillance course, and something one of the FBI guys who taught the class had said always stuck with him. If you think you're being followed, it is easy to check and very cheap insurance. If you're wrong, you might feel a little silly. But if you are right, you might keep yourself from winding up in deep shit. Maybe he was overly cautious, but as a professional military man, Howard had learned long ago that being prepared was not the same as being paranoid. There was a little state road running northeast to Manassas not far ahead, and Howard eased over into the exit lane. If the car behind him, looked like a white neon, kept going, he'd catch the next on-ramp and head on home. Six cars back, the neon reached the off-ramp and exited, a couple hundred yards behind him. Well, well. That didn't prove anything for certain. He remembered the FBI guy saying,
"Think about it. What would happen if one of your neighbors heading home happened to get behind you on the freeway? They'd make every turn you would, right?"
could be perfectly innocent. Don't jump to a conclusion until you are sure. And there are several simple ways, Howard remembered, to be sure. He tooled along on the state road, heading away from the suburbs toward the more rural country. There was an intersection ahead, and apparently the Occoquan Reservoir was to the left. Fine, left it is. He went maybe a quarter of a mile, didn't see the white neon turn behind him. So, okay, he was paranoid. He'd find a place to turn around and go home. He was relieved. There was a little gas station mini-mart, and Howard pulled in there. He used the bathroom, bought a can of root beer, and headed back to his car. If anybody had been following him, he'd had an excuse to stop. The idea was, the surveillance guy had told them, not to let the people following you know you knew they were there. Better the tale you know than one you don't. He kept going the way he'd been going, figuring to loop back around to a main road or the freeway eventually. 500 yards out of the mini-mart, he caught sight of the white neon in his rearview mirror. He was pretty convinced, but a few more tests should make it interesting. Howard made a series of turns until he was on a nice little country road and thoroughly lost. He was going to need to use the GPS to find his way out of here. Eventually, he found himself on another road that led, so the sign said, to the Civil War battlefield of Manassas. Several times, the neon disappeared from sight, sometimes for as long as 2 or 3 minutes, and it seemed to Howard that the guy tailing him had an uncanny ability to guess the right way to turn. Then it dawned on him that there might be some kind of bug on his vehicle. Damn, he should have thought of that sooner. There was no doubt that the neon was shadowing him. Now the questions were, who was it, and why were they following him? He could have called the highway patrol, had a few beefy state troopers pull the neon over and politely ask those questions. Of course, if the shadower turned out to be Lee, he'd just as soon not air that laundry in front of Virginia authorities. Or he could have scrambled a Net Force military team. But the truth was, he could take care of his own business. He had his sidearm right here. He was mindful of what Michaels had said about the DEA agent Brett Lee. He might not be too unhappy if Howard were to run his car into a tree somewhere and not survive the accident. Of course, it was a long way from following somebody around in your car to premeditated murder, and maybe it was somebody else altogether. Somebody Howard had run afoul of, out stalking for other reasons entirely. So, the thing was, he needed to box up whoever it was tailing him, stroll on over and have a few words with him and find out. Out here in the country, among all the trees and fields and pastures, he ought to be able to find a place to do that. He started looking. Malibu, California. Drain was not surprised when Shawanda Silverman got back to him within a day. She had a nice place all lined up, and any time he wanted to come by and take a look, she would make herself available. Times must be hard in the real estate biz, he figured. He got the address and information and said he'd be by to pick up the keys soon. All the legal stuff had been handled over the net. It was a done deal. He wouldn't go himself, of course. He didn't want his face to stick in her mind. Normally, he would have sent Tad, but Tad was still zoned out on the deck. Drain had tossed a blanket over him when it got dark and cool, then put a beach umbrella up to shade him when the sun came up. Old Tad might not move for another day or two, if ever he moved again at all. Fortunately, the bodyguards had shown up, and while 2 of the 4 he hired weren't the sharpest knives in the drawer, the other 2 were fairly bright. One of the smarter ones was Adam, a tall and muscular dishwater blonde in his late 20s. Drain decided to send Adam to meet with Ms. Silverman to collect the key for the new place. "Your name is Laszlo Mead, M-E-A-D, and you work for Projects, Inc.," he told Adam. "If she says anything about your voice sounding different, tell her you had a cold when you talked on the phone." "Won't be a problem," Adam said. He took a breath, blew half of it out, then said, "Hello there, Mrs. Silverman. I'm Laszlo Mead." Adam's impersonation was dead on. "Geez, that's good. I do a little stand-up now and then." After Adam was gone, Drain pondered the bodyguard situation a little. He wasn't planning on telling any of them the location of the safe house, just in case push came to shove and they got left behind when he took off. Adam was smart enough to figure it out, and if he wanted to bother, he could con it out of Silverman easily enough. After all, he would be Laszlo, wouldn't he? That might be a problem. So if things went into the toilet, he'd have to make sure Adam either got clear with him or wasn't going to be able to tell anybody what he knew about the hidey hole. Maybe it was time to get that gun, Drain figured. He had put the word out to his customers that the hammer was going to be available with the timer starting in 48 hours. Within a matter of a few minutes, he had 20 orders, and an hour after that, 25 more. That was 45 hits of the drug, plus one for Tad, if he was awake by then. Now all he needed was some chem. He decided to go to the RV to do his mixing when it came time. He wouldn't need the guards to go with him. They were mainly to protect his castle and his retreat if he needed to run. Nobody would know him from, well, Adam, out in the desert where the RV would meet him. He grinned. Yep, things were back on track. Except for that crap with his old man. Howard had driven for about 30 minutes until he found an empty tree-lined rural road narrow enough for his purpose. He turned right into a narrow tractor path leading to a cattle guard gate and a barbed wire fence. He shut off the engine. There were no houses nearby, just some cows grazing in the pasture. What he planned to do was get out, head through the pasture and into the little patch of woods opposite the cow pasture, and then circle behind the neon, which he figured would stop to see what he was up to. Once he was behind the shadower, he'd creep up on him with his revolver in hand. A simple plan, but one that should work. Behind him, the neon pulled off the road about 400 meters away, turned sideways with the passenger side facing Howard, and stopped. Howard got out of his car. He was still on the driver's side, closing the door, when there came a chink-chink as the passenger's and driver's side windows shattered, followed by the sound of a rifle shot. The bullet, traveling faster than the sound, missed him by maybe 2 inches. Shit! Howard took 2 steps to the front tire and dropped into a crouch behind it. He pulled his revolver. The engine was the best protection, and the heavy steel wheel would probably deflect a sniper's bullet aimed lower. Another shot, another round pierced the car's doors, through and through. This was bad. There was no other cover nearby. It was 50 meters through an open pasture to the tree line, and trying to cross the road the other way would be equally stupid. And his handgun was not going to do the job at 400 meters. He risked a quick look. Another shot echoed over the pasture land, and the round smashed into the car's side above the front tire, but stopped when it hit the engine. If the guy came toward him, he'd still have the advantage for another 300 meters, and if he circled around, Howard was really in deep shit. He could call for help, but it would never get there in time. What the hell was he going to... Up until this moment, he had forgotten what he had in the car's trunk. He felt a sudden surge of hope and possibility flow over him when he remembered. Howard scooted toward the rear of the car. Another shot hit the car amidships. He reached the back tire. He had his keys, and the trunk release was on the electronic alarm and opener. He put his revolver over the car's trunk, pointed it at the neon, and triggered off 3 shots as fast as he could. At the same time, he popped the trunk control, lunged under the still-rising lid, and grabbed the hard-shell case inside. He jerked it out and fell back behind the tire. The sniper's next shot was great. It hit the passenger side tire, lanced through, hit the driver's side tire and penetrated that, then punched a hole in the corner of the hard-shell carrying case, almost jerking it from Howard's grip. The car dropped to its rims, and he wasn't going to be driving it anywhere anytime soon. Howard popped the latches and dumped the parts of the 50 BMG rifle onto the ground. With a speed aided by adrenaline, he assembled the rifle in what had to be record time. He loaded the magazine. The shooter was probably using a scoped deer or sniper rifle. It would likely be a bolt action. So he was going to have to manually chamber a round after each shot, which meant that Howard would have half, maybe 3/4 of a second between shots. Not much time to get set up. And if it was a semi-auto, that would be really bad. But it was what he had. Howard took a grip on the heavy rifle. He stuck his head up, held it there for an agonizingly long time, maybe half a second, then ducked. The shot came, hit the trunk, zipped through, but missed by a good 6 inches. Then Howard leaped up, dropped the 50's bipod on the trunk's lid, slamming it shut, and put the red dot on the middle of the neon. He squeezed the trigger, and the recoil from the weapon knocked him back. The blast of sound deafened him. Even as he fought to regain his position, he chambered another cartridge. That would give the son of a bitch something to think about. Not so much fun when the victim can shoot back, is it? Howard looked through the scope. On high magnification, he could see the bullet hole where the side of the neon had buckled in around it, but there was no sign of the shooter. If the guy had any brains, now he would be behind the front tire with the engine block protecting him. Howard's ears were ringing, and he couldn't hear anything over that. He looked down, saw the earplugs that came with the rifle, and shoved them into his ears. No sign of the shooter. Fine. Let's see how you like being dinner, asshole. He put the red dot on the top of the front tire and squeezed a shot off, more careful now. The bullet must have shattered and splayed the engine compartment. Vapor came out from under the hood. He'd bet that car wasn't going anywhere either. Now it was time to get the troops out here. He pulled his Virgil and hit the emergency SIG control in a rapid sequence. Sir? Came a voice. Howard smiled. Gotcha now, sucker. Hold on a second. Howard shot the neon again, hit the front tire this time. The car sagged. I want a helicopter with a squad of troops ready to shoot, landing 20 meters east of the GPS location of my Virgil in 15 minutes maximum. This is not a drill. Yes, sir. But when the chopper from Quantico arrived and a dozen of Net Force's finest hit the ground and surrounded the mortally wounded neon, the shooter was nowhere to be found. The car was much closer to the tree line, and somehow the would-be assassin had managed to slip away. Washington, D.C. Jay looked up from his flat screen at the boss and the general. The shooter's car was stolen. They were in the airport in one of the VIP lounges that the boss had access to, waiting for the flight to L.A. If John Howard was rattled about somebody trying to shoot him, you couldn't tell it by looking at him. As a licensed federal agent, however, Howard would be carrying a gun with him onto the plane. Both Michaels and Jay had their air tasers with them, too, though Jay didn't try to kid himself that he was any kind of gunfighter, even with the non-lethal shock-'em-and-drop-'em tasers most Net Force personnel outside the military arm were issued. A stolen car. Not a major surprise there, Howard said. I don't suppose the lab rats managed to get any fingerprints or DNA for a match. Not yet, sir.
That isn't a surprise either, Michael said. Not if it was who we think it was in that car. How about Lee's whereabouts?
That's a little trickier, Jay said. We couldn't just have the FBI hunt him down, not without tipping our hand. According to a sub rosa contact we managed with the DEA, Mr. Lee was today taking some personal time. He was in Maryland visiting his paternal grandmother, who was in a nursing home just outside Baltimore. Accessible online records at the Sisters of St. Mary's Home for the Aged indicate that Mr. Lee did sign in about an hour before the attack on General Howard and signed out 10 minutes after the attack. Nobody has done a face-to-face with the staff to check that yet, however.
How easy would it be to fake the in-and-out signatures and records? Howard asked.
I could do it with both hands tied behind me.
I'd be very surprised if we can find a nurse or ward clerk who remembers seeing Lee there today.
Anything on other forensics at the scene? Michaels asked.
Nothing to write home about, Jay said. Shoe prints are a popular brand of cheap sneaker. Fibers from where the shooter kneeled appear to be lightweight gray sweatpants.
And the clothes and shoes and no doubt gloves are probably in a trash bin or burned to ash by now, Michaels said.
This was a pro, Howard said. If I hadn't had that portable cannon, I think he might well have taken me out.
You tell your wife about it? Michaels asked.
Howard looked at him.
Would you have told yours? The boss looked uncomfortable. I don't want my wife to worry either. I'll mention it after we catch the son of a bitch.
Jay didn't say anything. He'd have told Saji, but she was a Buddhist.
Banning, California. Drain had the air conditioner going full blast in the RV, and Ma and Pa Yeehaw had unshipped the little car they towed behind the RV and gone into town to do a little bar hopping or whatever, while Drain mixed up a new batch of the hammer. He'd hold off on adding the final catalyst until he got back to town. Now was a good time to check out the new safe house, and nobody would be looking over his shoulder there while he did the final mix. Once the clock started running, he'd send one of the bodyguards to FedEx with the packages, and that would be that. Another $45,000 into the secure E account, and wasn't life beautiful? He grinned. I wonder what the poor folks are doing now.
Beverly Hills, California. May Jean Kent was an impressive-looking woman, Michaels noted, oozing sexuality. She was beautiful, blonde, tanned, fit, and wore a halter top and hip-hugger pants. The star of Surf Days agreed to meet them at some local restaurant that was apparently the place to meet locally, and she was constantly waving at people who passed the outdoor table at which she, Michaels, Jay, and John had been situated.
Hi, Muffy. Hey, Brad. I'm sorry, Alex. What was that again?
Ms. Kent.
Oh, please. Call me MJ. Everybody does.
Michaels guessed her age at 30, but she was acting more like 18.
MJ, so tell me about this beach picture.
Oh, it was a terrible shoot. First thing was Todd, that's Todd Atchison, the director, was having a major crisis, and he ran out of Paxil, and he just kept yelling at everybody. Then Larry, that's Larry Wright, had a major fight with his boyfriend. He's gay. Such a waste of a perfect bod, you know. And George, I was so sorry to hear that he died. So sorry. But he was a major doper. Major.
Michaels glanced at Howard, who kept a straight face, but offered no help. Jay seemed entranced by the rise and fall of MJ's hooters under the barely able to hold them halter top.
Is there anything you can think of that might have a connection to something called Thor's hammer?
Oh, no, I don't remember anything about a sore hammer.
Where was the movie shot? Jay asked.
Where?
Yes, the location.
Malibu, on the beach.
Michaels got the gist of Jay's question and followed it up.
Anything unusual about the location?
Unusual? No, I don't think so. It was kind of like a private beach. Todd knew some of the owners who had houses right next to it, so they roped it off for the shoot.
Well, we thank you for your time, MJ. You've been great to us.
Waiting for the parking lot attendant to fetch the rental car, Howard said,
Well, that was helpful in a major way, you know.
Well, I suppose we should go try Larry, Michaels said, and hope that he and his boyfriend have patched things up since Surf Days.
Or Todd, maybe he's gotten his Paxil refilled.
Maybe we don't need to, Jay said.
Michaels and Howard looked at him. The inscription in the capsule said the grandchildren would know where to find him. I think MJ might have told us. The beach at Malibu, Michaels and Howard said together.
Big-time drug dealer could afford to live there.
It's a long stretch of coastline, Howard said. Hundreds of homes.
But movie shoots in cities have to have all kinds of permits. I can access the records for the surfer pick and find out exactly where the location was. That would narrow it down to a handful of houses. We could check ownership records on those, eliminate some of them.
Michaels said,
Okay, get online and find out what you can.
One other thing, I got a blip during the interview.
Jay waved the flat screen, looked at Howard.
Several witnesses, a couple of them nuns, attest that Brett Lee was in the nursing home yesterday when you were being shot at. It couldn't have been him.
Damn, Howard said. Then who?
Maybe your dog crapped on somebody's lawn,
Jay offered.
I don't think so. We don't have a dog.
Maybe you should get one. One with big teeth.
Malibu, California. When Tad woke up, he noticed a couple things. First, he was on the deck, with the beach umbrella doing its best to keep him in the shade, but starting to lose that battle. Second, there were some men with guns wandering around in the house. Fortunately, he recognized one of the gunslingers, so he realized the bodyguards had showed up, and Bobby must have decided to hire them. Shit happened when you went into hibernation. You got used to it. He looked at his watch, and the date showed he'd been out for a couple of days. Not too bad. He managed to get to his feet, using the umbrella for support, and headed toward the bathroom. The guy with the gun that Tad recognized nodded at him.
Hey, Tad.
Tad nodded in return. The name came to him, slow, but there.
Adam, how's it going?
Good. Bobby's out. He's supposed to be back in a while.
Cool.
He shambled into the bathroom, cranked the shower up, then stepped in. He needed to get to his stash. He stayed in the shower for 10 minutes, letting the spray pound him. He felt a little better when he stepped out and started drying himself. A little better wasn't going to cut it. His stash was in the wheel well of his car's trunk, and the car was parked in the lot of the sandwich place two down from them. When Bobby was running in paranoid mode, which was most of the time, he wouldn't let Tad keep anything in the house that might get them busted. Not even in the car, if Tad wanted to park it anywhere inside the security gate. Nothing more than you can swallow, Bobby told him, if somebody crashes the gate. The walk to the car wasn't that far, half a block, but of course it felt like 1,000 miles after a session with the hammer. Well, there was no help for it. Tad slipped on a pair of raggy black sweatpants, a black T-shirt, and a pair of black Zori sandals. Might as well get to it. It was going to take a while. Tad thought about his route for a minute. Out the front gate and along the road was longer. Okay, the beach. He headed for the deck stairs.
Michaels said, "One of those 3 or 4 houses?"
Howard drove. Michaels rode shotgun. Jay sat in the back. As they idled slowly along the highway, looking toward the beach, Jay said, "Gotta be. Permit specifies this part of the beach. That sandwich shop over there is in the movie. I pulled it up and scanned location shots. That house to the far left was built 2 years ago, so it wasn't there then."
"Do we have owners on these?"
"Yes. The pinkish one is owned by the actress Lori DeVivio."
DeVivio is, what, 60 and rich? Hard to imagine her making and peddling dope, Howard said. What about the other houses?
"Second one belongs to the chairman of the board of the Yokohama USA Bank. He's also 60-something and also richer than God. Third one, the pale blue and white one, is owned by a corporation called Projects, Inc. Some kind of corporate retreat, maybe. I'm running down the incorporation stuff now. They're out of Delaware. Fourth one belongs to Saul Horowitz. Don't know who Solly is, and the search bots haven't been more forthcoming so far."
"That sounds promising. Pull over there into that restaurant lot and let's think about this for a minute," Michaels said.
All four of the houses had security gates and fences, at least to the roadside. As Howard parked the car, a Mercedes convertible arrived in front of the third house and pulled up to the gate. The car's top was down, and a sun-bleached, blonde, and deeply tanned young man in a Hawaii shirt who looked like a surfer held up an electric remote and pointed it at the heavy steel gate, which slowly swung open to admit his car. He pulled into the drive, and the gate started to close behind him.
"Yo, Kahuna dude, surf's up!" "Thank you, Brian Wilson. You get the license plate number?"
"Crap, I'm sorry, boss."
"It's a vanity," Howard said. "P-R-O-J-E-C-T-S.
"Run it," Michaels ordered.
Jay, chagrined at his failure to catch the number, dialed up the California DMV and logged in using his NetForce access code. "Car is owned by Projects, Inc."
"So, what do you think, General?" Michaels said.
"Either it's that one or the Horowitz place. Rich bankers and movie stars might use dope, but they don't need to sell it."
"Just FYI, General, they found a bug on your car. That's how the shooter kept from losing you." Jay pointed at the flat screen. "Also, Mr. Lee, who, as we all know, couldn't have been said shooter, called in sick today."
"Something fatal, I hope," Howard said.
"And to keep things interesting, Mr. Zachary George is on vacation this week and next." Michaels said,
"Anything on the search bots for Mr. Horowitz yet?"
"Nope, but I don't think we need it."
"And why would that be?"
"Take a look at the death warmed over stick in black walking along the road there, coming from the sandwich place."
"So?"
"Look again, boss."
Michaels did. He frowned.
"Yeah," Jay said. "Kind of hard to picture him beating the crap out of a room full of bodybuilders and trashing a gym, isn't it?"
Michaels nodded. "But that's the guy."
"Never thought I'd see an actual match to a police ID composite," Jay said. "All we have to do is watch and see if he chooses door A or door B. Whichever one he picks, I'd bet my next month's salary against a bent quarter that's our dealer's house."
The three watched the man, who looked as if he might fall down any second. It took him a while to get there, but he finally did.
"And we have a winner. It's the surfer dude's pad. NetForce rules!"
Jay looked at Michaels.
"Now what, boss? We gonna go kick ass and take names?"
He held up his air taser and waggled it. Both Howard and Michaels laughed.
Michaels said, "We're not going anywhere. We're calling the FBI. They'll go in."
The front door opened.
"Hey, Bobby."
"Tad, you all right?"
"We'll be in about half an hour."
Tad headed for the kitchen. Drain followed, watched as Tad counted out 10 or 12 pills, filled a glass with water, and washed the drugs down in one big swallow.
"While you were napping, I set up some things. I was going to send one of the bodyguards, but now that you're awake, you can make the FedEx run."
"Okay."
"We're moving 45 hits of the hammer."
Tad raised an eyebrow.
"Might as well make hay while the sun shines," Drain said.
"You mixed it already?"
"Yep,
Did the final at the new house, so the stuff is just under an hour old.
Got mine?
It's too soon, Tad. You ought to sit this batch out. I'll be doing another bunch next week.
Tad didn't say anything, and Drain shook his head.
It's your funeral. Gee, boss, you don't think the three of us could take one surfer dude and a zombie?
Michaels had already put in the call to the director, and she in turn had called the local FBI shop and started the ball rolling.
Isn't this the zombie who wiped up the floor with a gym full of guys strong enough to pick up tractor trailers? Didn't you just bring that up?
Yeah, but he can barely move now. He can't be on the drug.
Howard said, There are too many things we don't know here, Jay. Think about it. What is the lay of the house? Who else is in there with them?
Jay said. So why didn't we call in Net Force troops? We can trust them.
That would have been my choice, Howard said, but it isn't our operation. We aren't supposed to even be here. We're outside our job description.
By rights, this belongs to the DEA. Even if the director decides to let FBI agents make the arrests, it's still a hot political potato.
Michaels looked at his watch.
We should have agents showing up within 30 or 40 minutes. We do it by the numbers, get part of the credit, and most importantly, the drug dealer is off the street. The end result is the same, no matter who hauls them off.
For how long is he off the street? Jay asked.
Excuse me?
This guy is carrying around a secret that is worth millions, maybe tens of millions. You said so yourself. Won't the drug companies be falling all over themselves to be the first in line to hire in the best legal team in the world? How high can his bail be?
Michaels nodded. He knew what Jay said was true.
Probably, but that's not our worry. We were supposed to find him. We found him. We did our part. We have to hope the rest of the system does its job. Can't be everywhere.
That sucks.
Welcome to the real world, son, Howard said. Drain gave Tad the mini-packets with the hammer caps, the list of addresses, and pointed him at the door. As the door closed behind Tad, the phone rang. It was the business line.
Polymers, Drain. If you have a lawyer, call him. You'll need him soon.
His father hung up without identifying himself, and Drain felt a rush as cold as liquid nitrogen envelop him.
You, he said, pointing to the nearest bodyguard. Go get Tad. Don't let him outside the gate.
The bodyguard hurried away. Drain's fear, cold at first, now flushed into an uncomfortable warmth that suffused his whole body. The old man had turned him in. No, if his father had done that, he wouldn't have had any second thoughts. The old man never apologized for anything. Drain was about to be busted. The old man had found out about it and had called to warn him. Son of a bitch. Almost more important than getting arrested was that his father had gone against 30 years of duty to tell his son he was in trouble. It was nothing short of a miracle. A miracle. Son of a bitch. Drain went to the security console in the kitchen and looked at the camera focused on the front gate. The cam was mounted on a gimbal, could look pretty much in any direction. He put the cam into a slow 360 pan. Across the street at the Blue Gull, a car was backed into a parking slot, and a man sat in the passenger seat, the window down, looking in the direction of Drain's house. Drain focused the cam on the car. He hit the zoom. The glare on the windshield wouldn't let him see inside, but the security folks knew about glass glare, and a dial let him polarize the lens. The windshield cleared to show a second man in the driver's seat and a third man in the back.
Shit! They were already in place.
Tad came back into the kitchen.
What's up?
Company, look.
Tad looked.
So, some guys in a car. Doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, except that my father just called and told me to call my lawyer.
Your father? Oh, shit.
Exactly, Drain took a deep breath. He said to Adam, Go see if anybody is hanging around out back.
Adam returned in 30 seconds.
Nope.
Okay, they haven't covered the rear of the house yet. Tad, Adam, we're going for a walk. The rest of you stay here. If anybody comes to call in the next 5 minutes, don't let them in. After that, it doesn't matter. You don't know anything. Not who I am, not where I've gone. You got that?
There was a murmur from the guards. They pulled their pistols out. To Adam, Drain said, "You have an extra one of those?" He pointed at the gun in Adam's holster.
"Sure. Give it to me."
Adam did so. The gun was kind of squarish, black, and made out of some sort of polymer. Drain said,
"What do I do?"
"It's a Glock 40. Point it like you would your finger and pull the trigger. You have 11 shots. Drain hefted the black plastic gun, then tucked it into his pants in the back, under the Hawaiian shirt.
"Let's go."
"Here comes the cavalry," Howard said. Three unmarked late-model sedans cruised slowly up the highway from the south. The cars turned into their parking lot and pulled to a halt.
"More behind us," Jay said.
Howard looked around and saw three more cars and a van convoy into the lot. A tall man in a gray sweatsuit got out of the lead vehicle and walked to the passenger side of their car.
"Commander Michaels, I'm Special Agent in Charge Delorme."
Michaels waved at Howard and Gridley.
"General John Howard and Jay Gridley."
"No offense, sir, but isn't Net Force supposed to be a computer-based operation?"
"It is."
"With all due respect, sir, once you located the suspect, you should have called the proper agency in right away, not come out here on your own."
Gridley leaned forward.
"Yeah, well, last time we found a suspect, the proper agency rolled in like gangbusters and shot him dead. We were kind of hoping to avoid that this time."
Howard grinned.
"Thank you, Jay."
To Delorme, Michaels said,
"Don't worry. We'll sit out of your way while you do your job."
"Sir,"
Delorme said. He stood and waved his hand in a circle, index finger pointing up at the sky. Three of the cars pulled out of the lot and across the highway, skidding to stops on either side of the target house. Doors opened, and agents in body armor with FBI lettered in big day-glow yellow on their backs, armed with assault rifles, boiled out of the cars. Other agents alighted from the cars still in the lot and ran across the road. Two cars rolled toward places where the beach was accessible from the road, and more agents leaped out and hut-hut-hutted to circle around behind the house.
"Not bad deployment," Howard said. "A little slow, kind of sloppy, but not bad for civilians."
"Might as well sit back and enjoy the show," Michaels said.
"Shit!"
"What?" Howard and Jay said together. Michaels pointed. A big Dodge rolled out of the sandwich shop parking lot and roared away, heading north.
"The zombie is driving that car."
Howard didn't hesitate. He started the rental car's engine and pulled out onto the highway. Jay said,
"Why don't you get closer, General? We might lose them."
"If they see us behind them, we'll sure as hell lose them. We're going up a hill here. This gutless piece of crap rental can't begin to keep up with that hot rod."
Michaels was on his Virgil, trying to call the sack running the bust. The man wasn't answering.
"He'll have his comms shut off," Howard said. "You don't want to have to answer the phone in the middle of a firefight."
The boss swore.
"Try FBI HQ," Jay offered.
Michaels shook his head.
"Probably half their guys are on this raid already, and it's going to take anybody else as long to get here as it did to get to the beach, maybe longer."
"What about the local police?" Howard said.
"Who are the local police? Where are we?"
"Call CHP," Howard said. "Probably they can get here fastest, put up a roadblock. Better than nothing."
Michaels nodded. He tapped a button on the Virgil, then started talking. The woman's voice coming from the Virgil was calm enough, but her news was bad.
"Sorry, sir, but we have a major traffic accident on the Ventura. 10 cars and a semi full of hazardous chemical that's on fire. All available officers are there or on their way there. I can put you through to the county sheriff's patrol."
"Damn it."
Michaels shut the Virgil off.
"We're okay," Howard said. "We stay with them. They'll stop sooner or later. When they do, we'll get whatever police agency that covers the area to roll."
"If we don't lose them."
"If we don't lose them," Howard agreed.
"Close," Adam said.
"FBI assault team looked like. What did you guys do?"
"Don't worry about that," Bobby said from the back seat. "Close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. They didn't follow us, right, Tad?"
Tad looked into the rearview mirror. He hadn't gotten his stack just right. He was having a little trouble focusing his vision. There was a curve maybe a quarter mile back, and if he squinted hard, Tad could see that the road was empty, at least that far.
"No, nobody followed us."
Adam, in the front, turned around and looked.
"Where are we going? The safe house?"
"Yeah, for now. After that, I think maybe we need to take a nice long trip somewhere out of the country."
"All of us?" "No reason for you to go. Nobody knows who you are. We'll give you a nice bonus, and you can get back to your life."
Fuzzed as his brain was, Tad didn't think that was a very good idea, but he didn't say anything. Bobby always knew what he was doing.
Fine by me, Adam said.
He turned around to watch the road in front of them again. Bobby said,
Loud noise, Tad.
Tad didn't have time to think about that when two bombs went off and the windshield spiderwebbed on the passenger side.
Fuck!
Tad screamed. The car slewed onto the shoulder, hit a couple of rocks, and jounced hard. He fought the wheel, managed to get it back on the asphalt. Tad looked into the mirror, saw Bobby just leaning back into the seat, that black gun in his hand. He glanced over at Adam. There was a bloody splotch on his chest and more blood oozing from a hole right over his heart. His left eye and part of his nose was also gone. It took a second for Tad to get it. Bobby had just shot Adam, twice, in the back and in the back of the head. One of the bullets had gone right through him and through the windshield.
Jesus fucking Christ, Bobby!
He was a liability. He knew where the safe house was. He knew you. We have to make a clean break here. No loose ends.
What was that? Jay said. Sounded like some kind of firecracker. Look at the car.
Howard eased up on the gas pedal and the rental car slowed dramatically. The Dodge ran off the road, bounced, then skidded back onto the tarmac. Gunshots, Howard said. Two of them.
They shooting at us?
Michael said, no, not us. Somebody in the car. The three men stared at the car, which rounded another curve and disappeared. Howard shoved the accelerator pedal down. The little car moaned, and not much else. He pounded the steering wheel.
Piece of Japanese crap, go!
Michaels reached for his Virgil. Could he risk calling the DEA in? Well, why not? The decision was interrupted by his Virgil beeping. The ID showed it was the director. He tapped the link on and held the Virgil up so the cam could see his face.
Yes, ma'am?
My sec tells me that the drug dealer was not in the house they raided, nor was the other man. What is the situation there, Commander?
Three men managed to escape by car just as the raid went down, ma'am. The agents didn't see them. General Howard, Jay Gridley, and I are in pursuit. We are heading east over the mountains at the moment. We've been unable to contact Sac Delorme's team. I was thinking we might call in the DEA. They'll have air support.
Already done, Commander. They should have a helicopter in the air by now, and they are also tracking your Virgil's GPS.
I see.
We have to let them in, Commander. There is no choice in the matter. You understand?
He understood, all right.
Yes, ma'am.
Try to maintain your surveillance. I expect you'll be seeing the DEA forces soon. Call me when you have something to report.
Yes, ma'am.
Michaels discommed. Howard glanced over at him.
You heard the director. Try to stay with him. DEA is in the air.
But that wasn't quite true, Michaels realized a few seconds later. The DEA had a helicopter, all right. He saw it not more than a block ahead as they rounded the next curve. The copter was parked across the middle of the road. Drain saw the helicopter blocking the road a good 2 seconds before Tad's drugged reaction time finally kicked in and he slammed on the brakes. The big Dodge's wheels locked and the car skidded to a rubber-burning stop.
Shit!
Tad said.
Turn around! Turn around!
But as he said it, Drain looked over his shoulder in time to see a car 100 feet behind slew to a stop and turn so it blocked the road. Tad hit the brakes again. To their left was a rocky slope, the wall of the mountain. To the right, a fairly steep drop down the hillside into a valley of rock, dried brown bushes, and eucalyptus. A half dozen men with guns were crouched around the copter, pointing their weapons at the Dodge. Drain looked back in time to see three men pile out of the other side of the car behind them. They came up behind the hood and trunk and pointed weapons, too.
Well, shit. Fuck, what do we do?
Drain thought fast. There was a dead body in the front seat of their car. Tad had enough drugs to stone a parade, not even counting the scores of hammer caps. This was bad. Drain leaned forward and gave Tad the pistol he had.
Here, take this. We'll get slaughtered.
Drain reached around the seat and took Adam's pistol from the dead man's holster.
Maybe not. I've got an idea. Stick the gun out the window and shoot it into the air.
Why?
Just do it.
Tad did. The men behind the copter ducked, but they didn't return fire. Drain almost smiled. Good. That was good. They wanted him alive. Alive, he was valuable. Dead, he was worthless. And now Tad, bless him,
had powder residue on his hand, showing he had fired a gun.
Okay, let's think about this. We got their attention, but we're boxed, so we're going to have to do this with lawyers. We have money, and we have power. The pharmaceutical companies want what I have. So we get out with our hands up and surrender.
You sure?
Trust me, I know what I'm doing. One phone call will have some very heavyweight people lined up to help us.
Okay, man.
Of course, Tad would have to take the fall for killing Adam. And since Tad would get shot resisting arrest or trying to escape, he wouldn't say otherwise. Train could pull that off. If he yelled,
"Hey, don't shoot, Tad! Put the gun down!"
at the right moment, the feds would hose Tad. DEA rules of engagement wouldn't be that different from the FBI rules when facing an armed perp. Too bad, but Tad had one foot in the grave anyhow. He liked him, but his death might as well count for something. No point in Tad being dead and Drain being in jail, was there? Drain climbed over the seat.
What are you doing?
I want to be right behind you when we get out. We don't want them to think you're reaching for something when you move the seat to let me out.
Oh, yeah.
Tuck that gun into your belt and keep your hands in the air when you get out.
Tad nodded.
Okay.
Howard had braked and turned the car to block the road, and the three of them jumped out on the driver's side, away from the stopped Dodge.
Get those tasers out, for all the good they'll do, Howard said.
He pulled his gun from under his jacket, crouched behind the front wheel, and pointed the gun over the hood.
See if you can get the DEA there on your Virgil's emergency band and tell them not to shoot us.
Michaels nodded. He was the commander of Net Force, but he was willing to defer to the general in this kind of situation. He hit the emergency call button, got the Net Force operator, and told him to patch them through to the DEA team. The FBI director should have their number. Behind them, a car approached. Howard turned and waved at it frantically.
Stop!
The car, a dark minivan, did stop. The passenger door opened and a man jumped out and ran toward them. He had a gun in his hand. Howard swung his revolver around and almost shot the guy. Then they all recognized him. Brett Lee of the DEA.
What's the situation? He asked.
What the hell are you doing here?
Michaels responded.
I was following you, Lee said.
They all stared at him.
Look, okay, I screwed up on the bust at the movie star's house, okay? My job is going away at the least. I need to help catch this guy so I don't leave in total disgrace. I need a little victory.
That made sense. Before anybody could speak, Michaels Virgil started its musical sting. No ID sig.
Commander Michaels, Riley Clark, DEA. Is that you in the car behind the suspects?
Yes, and I have Brett Lee here with me.
Hold your positions and please don't shoot unless you are fired upon.
As if his words were a signal, a gun went off. From the Virgil, Clark's excited voice came,
Negative, negative, do not return fire. The gun was pointed into the air. Repeat, hold your fire.
Michaels raised from his squad and looked. The driver's side door opened and two men stepped out, their hands in the air. The zombie and the surfer. What an odd-looking pair they were.
Which one is a chemist? Lee asked.
Jay said,
Gotta be the surfer.
Drain felt tight, knowing all those guns were pointed at him, but he also knew he was the golden goose. Sure, he might have to do some time at one of those country club honor farms somewhere, but in the end, he was going to cut a deal and he was going to walk away rich. The feds would bargain with him because he had something everybody wanted. He could turn people into superhumans. He was smarter than the guys they sent against him. Always had been, always would be. He could think circles around them. This was a temporary setback, that was all. He was a genius, and he'd show them just how smart he was. He smiled.
Don't shoot!
Drain yelled.
We give up!
Something was wrong, Howard felt, but he couldn't put his finger on it. Lee was right here next to him, and if Lee raised that pistol, he was going to bat it down. But that wasn't it. It was something else. Then he knew. It hit him like a lightning bolt. Lee had gotten out on the passenger side. He twisted around, looked at the van. Shit! The driver's door was open and a man was behind it, a rifle resting on the windowsill, but not aimed at Howard or Michaels or Jay or Lee. Howard swung his revolver around. The rifle went off. Tad was looking right at him when Bobby's head exploded.
Fuck! They shot Bobby! Tad didn't even think about it. He bolted, ran straight for the only way not full of guns, right over the side of the hill. He hit 5 or 6 yards down, his legs collapsed, and he rolled himself into as much of a ball as he could, bouncing and smashing into creosote bushes and rocks and dirt, until he hit something so hard it took his consciousness. Michaels watched in slow motion as John Howard shoved his handgun forward and started pulling the trigger. Brett Lee screamed, and he tried to point his pistol at Howard. "He's going to shoot John," Michaels realized. Michaels lunged, slamming into Lee. They both sprawled on the road. Lee dropped his gun to break his fall, hit, rolled up, and kicked at Michaels. Without thinking, Michaels swept his right hand down and up again in an arc, caught Lee's ankle, and at the same time dropped into a low position and shoved with his left hand at Lee's chest. Lee fell backward, hit the road flat on his back, and his head thumped the asphalt and bounced. He was stunned enough so he didn't move. Michaels blinked and realized that he had just done an ankat, a throw against an unweighted leg. Jay, who probably didn't have any more of an idea of what was going on than Michaels did, stepped up and shot Lee with his taser. Lee jittered on the dusty road as the electrical charge spasmed his muscles. Michaels turned to look at Howard, who was up and moving toward the minivan, gun still extended in front of him. Michaels didn't see his taser. He must have dropped it, but he hurried to join Howard. Behind the still-open driver's door, which had several holes in it, a man lay on the ground, bleeding, a rifle next to him. His chest was a ruin, and Michaels knew the man had been shot in the heart. He'd be dead soon if he wasn't already. He couldn't see the man's face until Howard kicked the door shut, and when he did, it was not really all that much of a surprise. The heart-shot man was Zachary George of the NSA. When Tad woke up, he didn't know where he was. Outside, somewhere. He had cuts and bruises he didn't remember and felt like crap, but that wasn't anything new. Damn, how did he get here? Where was here, anyway? The sight of Bobby's head blowing apart filled his memory. Oh, shit. Shit, shit, shit. It all came back to him in a jumbled rush of pain and emotion. Jesus. He looked at his watch to see how long he'd been out, but the crystal was shattered, the hour hand gone. The feds would be coming for him, and he had to get moving or they'd catch him. Probably none of them would have just jumped off the fucking cliff like he had, but they'd figure a way down soon enough. He didn't know how long ago it had been. It felt like it was still afternoon, so maybe he'd only been out for a few minutes. He wasn't going to get far in his condition, he knew. He reached into his pocket and came out with one of the hammer packets. A couple of them fell on the ground. Well, he sure wasn't going to be making any deliveries anytime soon, and the clock was running on this batch. He had until tomorrow around noon before the stuff would all go sour. Use it or lose it, and he couldn't take them all. He tore open the packet and dry-swallowed the hammer cap, thought about it for a few seconds, then ripped open another packet and took that cap, too. It would be a while before the stuff would kick in, and he couldn't sit here waiting for it, no matter how much he hurt. The gun he'd had tucked into his belt was gone. His car was God knew how far up the hill, surrounded by feds. He was screwed. And Bobby was dead. They'd fucking executed him. He'd had his hands up, and they had blown his head off. Tad felt a surge of anger well up, filling him with murderous rage. He wanted to run back up that hill and tear them apart with his bare hands. The anger was good, but it was barely strong enough to get him to his feet. If he could stay clear long enough for the hammer to kick in, he'd be okay. Once the drug took hold, he'd be able to travel at speed. And go where? The safe house. They didn't know about that. Bobby had the place stocked. There was some running away money stashed there, more in the safe at the storage space. Bobby was dead. Tad couldn't believe it. Bobby was smart, good-looking, rich. He had everything going for him. And they cooked him. Blam! Just like that. Oh, they were going to pay for killing Bobby. He was fucking going to make them pay. No sign of the zombie? Jay said.
The DEA people haven't found him yet, Michael said. General Howard went down with them and found this. He held up a purple capsule. There were several of them under a bush down there. DEA got the rest, but it doesn't look as if they have turned sour yet, so this is still an active capsule.
No great loss. We got the chemist.
We have his body, Howard said. Jay blew out a sigh. What a fuck-up this had been. I bet forensics will match that rifle George had to the bullets they found in my car at Manassas, Howard said. George was the shooter. That's why Lee had such a great alibi.
So they were in it together all along. But why shoot this guy Drain?
I don't know, Michaels said.
Lee had recovered from the fall and taser shock and was handcuffed and sitting in the back of one of the DEA vehicles that had finally arrived. He was more than a little distraught when he saw the body of George. He'd sobbed and begun crying.
Bastard, Lee had said to Howard. You killed him!
Damn straight, Howard had replied. I only wish I'd shot him 2 seconds sooner.
Bastard! You're a dead man!
Not by your hand, pal. You're an accessory to murder and attempted murder, probably 7 kinds of conspiracy and God knows what else. You're going away for a long, long time.
Maybe not. Maybe I have something to trade.
Better be damn good, whatever it is. And between you and me and my colleagues here, if I see you on the street anywhere close to me or mine, I'll drop you and worry about the consequences later.
You threatening me, General Howard?
Michaels said,
You must be mistaken, Mr. Lee. I didn't hear any threats.
Jay? Nope, I didn't hear anything at all.
On the drive down the hill, Michaels called Tony.
Hey, how's the glamour there in Tinseltown?
Great if you like chase scenes and shootouts.
Michaels filled her in on the operation.
So, when are you coming home?
Probably tomorrow morning. We need to file reports with the local FBI and DEA offices, talk to their supervisors, like that.
At least it's all wrapped up.
Not completely. The zombie, that's Thaddeus Burshaw, we got that from his car registration, got away.
That's not major, is it?
Not that we can tell. Probably no more than an errand boy. The dealer was Robert Drain. He had a degree in chemistry. Also had a father who was with the Bureau for 30 years.
Interesting.
DEA and FBI put out an APB net in the street on Burshaw. They'll find him eventually. Anyway, he's not our problem anymore.
I miss you.
Yeah, I miss you too. See you tomorrow. I'm thinking maybe I'll take a couple personal days and we can do something.
I'd like that. They were way too slow coming down the hill to find him. By the time he heard them yelling at each other, Tad was 600 yards away, and the double hit of Magic Purple was coming on strong. 10 minutes after that, he was able to run like the wind. He could run faster, see better, and make quicker decisions, and no way they were going to catch him from behind. 3 miles or so away, he angled back up toward the road, then paralleled it until he came to a tiny shopping center. He found a motorcycle chained to a light pole. The owner had trusted the lock and chain, and so he'd left a spare ignition key under the seat, and the sucker, a mid-sized Honda, cranked right up. Tad sailed eastward down the hill in the dark, hitting speeds of 80, 90 miles per hour with the lights off, whipping past startled drivers who heard him but couldn't see him until he appeared in their headlights. Must have scared the crap out of them. If the feds had roadblocks, they must have been closer to the place where the copter had landed. They weren't figuring on a guy who could run 3 miles in the dark. He made it to the safe house without incident. Inside, he flipped on the television and tuned it to CNN headline news. He didn't feel like eating, but he knew he needed fuel and liquid, so he grabbed a big can of ham slices and a 6-pack of Evian water. The info wasn't long in coming. The drug dealer who had been slain had been located through the efforts of the FBI's computer arm, NetForce. The leader of that organization, Commander Alexander Michaels, had come all the way from Washington, D.C. to be in on the raid. The news cam had footage of Michaels, right out there on the road, looking down at the body of some agent who had been killed by the drug dealers during the raid. Yeah, well, if one of theirs was dead, the feds had done it themselves. Bobby hadn't done it, and except for that one shot Tad put into the sky, he hadn't fired either. Lying fuckers. There were interviews with local DEA and FBI agents, as well as some computer geek for NetForce. It had been a coordinated operation among the three agencies, so it seemed. But NetForce got the big pat on the back for coming up with the information that led to the suspected drug dealers. One who said drug dealers had escaped. They flashed a picture of Tad along with his name. Driver's license photo. So they had ID'd him. No big deal. The news moved on, and he shut it off. When he looked down at the ham can, it was empty. He had eaten 2 pounds of ham and downed 6 bottles of water, and he didn't even feel full. Probably his last meal. Tad thought about it for a few seconds. Commander Alexander Michaels, Net Force, Washington, D.C. A long way to travel for somebody in his shoes. And nothing he did would bring Bobby back. Dead was dead. Why bother? Yeah, well, fuck it. He'd almost reached the end of his string anyhow. He went into the bathroom. Bobby had stocked the place with all kinds of shit they might need if they had to run. He found scissors and an electric razor with a trim attachment and cut his already short black hair into a flat top. He used half a bottle of hair coloring on his new cut. He shaved off his lip hanger goatee, pulled out his earrings, and tossed them. After the hair was bleached to an ugly yellow, he showered, got out and rubbed himself down with bronzing gel. He found some slacks, a dress shirt, socks, and running shoes, all in pale gray or white, not his look at all. There was a pair of wire-rimmed glasses with plain glass lenses, and he put them on. He could almost pass for normal. There was about $50,000 in cash in frozen food packages in the freezer. He took about $10,000. He didn't expect he'd need that much, and if he somehow got back here, unlikely, he could get the rest then. There were some fake photo IDs in a desk drawer. Tad picked up a set, looked to see that the driver's license was from Texas and that the name was Raymond Selling. Bobby's little joke. Selling was the winner of last year's Los Angeles Marathon race. He'd done one for Richard Kimball, too, from the old TV series The Fugitive. Bobby was a riot. Had been a riot. He took one of the clean digital phones in the kitchen and punched in a number from memory. "Yo," came a deep voice.
"Hallie, it's Tad. I need something."
"Yeah, me too. Your money in my pocket. Go."
"I want an address for Commander Alexander Michaels. He's the head of Net Force. His home address. How long?"
40-45 minutes.
"Call me back on this number when you get it."
"Cost you $500.
"Not a problem."
Tad took his new self outside. There were 2 cars in the garage, a year-old tan minivan with a baby on board sticker on the back window, and a 3- or 4-year-old Dodge Dakota. Both had keys in the ignitions. He paused long enough to grab the rear bumper of the truck, to squat and lift the tires clear of the pavement a few times to burn off some of his excess energy. Then he climbed in and cranked the engine. He headed for the airport. On the way, he called and booked a first-class seat on the next nonstop flight to Washington, D.C. The plane wouldn't leave for 3 hours. Another 5 or so hours to fly there, figure on maybe 2 more to find the place. Call it 10 hours, be there by 8 or 9 a.m. He'd be riding the hammer for that long, and when he started to come down, he had a whole shitload of caps that would be good until noon, and another 12 hours of hammer to ride after he took it. Midnight tomorrow, easy. That should be more than enough time to have a long chat with Commander Alexander Michaels of Net Force, and to teach the fucker what a bad mistake he had made in helping to get Bobby Drain killed. Plenty of time. Los Angeles, California. Michaels had just finished shaving and was getting dressed when there came a knock on the hotel room's door. It was Jay.
"FBI got a lead on Burshaw."
Jay held up the flat screen so Michaels could see the image thereon. A blonde-haired man with glasses, dressed in casual sports clothes.
"They sure this is him?"
"Check the side-by-side." A magnified image of the blonde appeared next to an identical-sized headshot of Tad Burshaw. Overlay grids appeared, numbers scrolled, and yellow highlight outlines pulsed over the features. "This is him."
"Where was this taken?"
"LAX last night. The match cam sent a SIG to FBI HQ, but the priority tag imprint was malfunctioning. Nobody got around to scanning the file until a few minutes ago."
"So much for infallible technology. So where did he go?"
"According to the gate cam at CrossCon Air, he took a nonstop red-eye to Washington, D.C. Plane landed around 2 a.m. this morning, Eastern Time. From the passenger list, they know he's using the name Raymond Selling."
"Like the marathon runner?"
"Who?"
"Selling is the fastest long-distance man in the country, probably the world."
"I don't follow the sport."
"Why Washington?"
Jay shrugged.
"Well, maybe we'll bump into him when we get home."
"I hope not. If he's got any of that dope left, he's not somebody I want to meet face to face." Michaels reached for his sport coat.
What time does our flight leave?
Couple hours. Be back in Washington about 7 p.m.
Well, let's go have breakfast and enjoy the L.A. sunshine.
Jay closed the flat screen and they started for the door. He still had a worried look. Michaels said,
Something else?
Yeah, a major problem. In-house security says somebody got past the NetForce firewalls and into the mainframe last night.
I thought that wasn't possible.
It's not, for most people. I could do it, and if I could, some others could, a handful.
Was anything damaged or stolen?
Fortunately not. Security says the probe managed to get into the personnel files. They are read-only for the GAO auditor, whom by law we have to let in. Somebody had to know about that to use it.
Who would know?
Ex-programmer, maybe ex-ops, FBI, GAO, maybe even NetForce.
Really?
We've had people quit. Fired a few, too. Programmers always leave themselves a back door when they are building secure systems.
So what now?
We'll run down all ex-employees with enough skill to pull it off. My hope is that it'll turn out to be some kid hacker, but that wouldn't be the way smart money bets.
Stay on it, Jay. In the meantime, let's don't keep General Howard waiting.
On the way to the elevator, something about what Jay said bothered him. He couldn't quite nail it down as they stepped into the lift. Jay pushed the button for the lobby.
That intrusion last night, do we know where it came from?
Not really. We were able to track it as far as the West Coast. That's it.
Michaels thought about that for a second.
Why would anybody capable of breaking into a secure system like NetForce's mainframe want to look at our personnel records?
Jay shrugged. Find out if somebody works there, what they do exactly, how long, maybe how much somebody gets paid?
You've skipped one. Find out where somebody lives.
Yeah, that could be.
Michaels felt a sudden chill.
What if it's Burshaw? What if he is looking to even the score for the death of his friend?
That's a reach, boss. Guy who pulled the trigger on Drain is dead.
Burshaw wouldn't know that. He went over the side of the hill as soon as the shooting started.
The elevator reached the ground floor and opened. The two men stepped out and walked toward the hotel's coffee shop.
You were on CNN's coverage. The FBI and DEA weren't saying much. Nobody said who shot Drain, only that he was killed. And who was getting most of the credit for finding the drug dealers?
That'd be us, Jay said.
Yes, and there were only three of us there, you, me, and General Howard.
Still a reach.
Burshaw escapes, somebody on the West Coast gets into NetForce's personnel files, Burshaw disappears, then shows up on a flight to Washington. I don't like it. If you were him and you were pissed off because somebody had murdered your friend while he stood there with his hands up and you wanted to do something about it, who would you go after?
Jay didn't say anything.
Yeah, that's what I thought. The man in charge, who was right there on the scene. You could be waiting for him when he got home. Only thing is, Tony is already there.
He pulled his Virgil, hit the Vox ax, and said,
Call home.
After five rings, the message recorder came on.
Hello, you've reached area code 202-357. Tony, if you were there, pick up or call me back ASAP.
Michaels felt a sense of panic. He tapped the resend button and selected 5-minute intervals to repeat until a connection was made.
She's not answering.
She could be asleep, outside, watering the plants, a dozen things, Jay said.
John Howard stood in the short line of people waiting to get into the coffee shop. He saw Jay and Michaels approaching, smiled at them. Michaels didn't feel like smiling back. Howard caught it. What's the matter, Commander? Michaels ran through it. Howard said, Jay's probably right. It's probably nothing. But just to be on the safe side, how about I have a couple of my people drop by and check?
I would appreciate that.
One more thing. Jay's the one who got all the attention on TV. Might not be a bad idea for him to get a hold of Saji and tell her to get somewhere safe. Michaels nodded. But Jay was already pulling out his Virgil. Saji answered, and everyone relaxed a little. Howard pulled his own Virgil and spoke quietly into it. He turned to Michaels and said, Somebody will be there in 20 minutes. They'll call you back or have Tony call you.
Michaels nodded. Thank you. Call home yourself, John, just to be sure. Then we might as well go have breakfast.
But until he heard from Tony, he wasn't the least bit interested in eating. Washington, D.C.
It was almost noon, and Tony was in the kitchen and about to fix herself some lunch when there came a terrific crash. She knew who the intruder was as soon as he came through the side door, a door he opened by kicking it, almost tearing it from its hinges. She didn't recognize him, but it had to be the drug guy who had escaped. His hair and eyebrows were bleached, but it was him. As she stood there in her nightgown and ratty bathrobe, she knew she had only one advantage. What he saw was a small, pregnant woman who couldn't possibly be a threat to him. And in truth, she wasn't much of a threat. Any strenuous activity could cause her to lose the baby. She had to fall back on one of the first principles of her art, deception. So she played it as he would expect.
"Who are you? What do you want?"
"Alexander Michaels."
"He's not here."
"I figured. He's still in Los Angeles, isn't he?" She didn't say anything. She couldn't make it too easy. He grinned. There was a wooden coat tree by the door. He grabbed it, turned it sideways, and snapped it over his thigh as if it were a twig.
"Don't fuck with me, lady. I'm not in the mood, okay?"
It wasn't hard to act afraid.
He won't be home until tonight. His flight gets here around 7 o'clock.
Burshaw, that was the name Alex had told her, grinned his mad smile again.
"Ah, good. That will give us plenty of time to get acquainted. What's your name?"
"Tony."
"Wife or girlfriend?"
Wife.
"Well, don't worry, Tony. I'm not going to hurt you. How far along are you?"
5 months.
"Congratulations. You do what I tell you, you and the kid will live. You can call me Tad. Why don't you take me on a tour of the place?"
"Okay." The comm chirped.
"Don't answer it," he said.
Tad followed Michael's wife as she led him through the condo, where he made sure there weren't any surprises waiting for him. Every 5 minutes or so, the phone would ring, and he'd just shake his head at her. In the garage was an old Chevrolet convertible, the hood up and parts of the engine laid out on a workbench.
"Very nice."
He walked over and put one hand on the car's fender.
"Your old man is into cars."
"Yes. He rebuilds them. It's his hobby." Tad needed to work off some of the hammer's insistent energy, and while he was horny again, a pregnant woman didn't do it for him. A little drum work on the Chevy would do fine. He saw a ball-peen hammer hung on pegs over the workbench and went to get it. The hammer working a hammer. He liked the symmetry in that. But when he got to the bench, he noticed something else. Little pieces of ivory, needles, a microscope. Scrimshaw.
"Your husband has a lot of time on his hands," he said.
He nodded at the bench.
"Cars and art. That's when he's not having guys murdered."
"My husband doesn't have people murdered," she said. She glared at him. He smiled. She had balls, this pregnant woman did. She'd seen what he could do when she knew he could kill her with a backhand, but here she was defending her old man anyway. Tad had never heard his mother ever say a kind word about his father. Give Tony here a point for loyalty.
"Tell that to my friend Bobby. He was standing with his hands in the air and the feds blew his head apart."
"My husband didn't order that. NetForce does computer investigation. They aren't field operatives."
"Yeah, well, he was there. I saw him on the evening news."
He was about to go do the car when he saw the capsule. He shook his head.
"That fucking Bobby. He was too smart for his own good sometimes."
He turned to look at her.
"You know about this? Your old man talked to you about his work?"
"Yes, sometimes."
"Bobby was a genius, you know. He had contempt for the feds because of his father. His father was with the FBI. He and Bobby didn't get along, so Bobby left clues in every fifth cap. Little riddles."
He waved at the cap.
"That's how they found him, isn't it? Some geek at your husband's computer farm figured it out, didn't he?"
She didn't say anything.
"Come on, you might as well tell me. I can't kill him any deader than dead, can I?"
"Please don't kill him."
"Bobby might have fucked up because he underestimated his opposition. You tend to do that when you're always smarter than them. But he should be alive. Somebody has got to pay for that."
He was really ready to pound the car now, and he reached for the tool when the doorbell rang.
"Maybe we ought to see who it is."
The security cam Alex had installed showed two men in uniform with holstered pistols. Net Force troopers.
Cops?
Net Force security.
I thought your husband was a desk jockey.
He is, but they have some special teams for certain situations.
Yeah, like executing drug dealers.
The two at the door rang the bell again. And again. They weren't going away. Tony felt a surge of hope, but she quickly quelled the feeling. The two men at her door were in immediate danger.
Get rid of them. And you better not give them a fucking hint. You do, they die. You and the kid die.
Burshaw stood behind her and to one side, out of sight, as Tony opened the door. Yes?
Mrs. Michaels, we're sorry to bother you, but Commander Michaels has been trying to contact you.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry about that. I was working out, doing my aerobics. I turned off the ringer and let the computer take messages.
Yes, ma'am. If you would call Commander Michaels at your convenience, that would be very helpful.
I will. I'm going to go take a nap, and I'll call him when I wake up. Sorry to have caused you any trouble.
No trouble at all, ma'am. Have a good day.
When they were gone, Burshaw said,
That was all right, except for the part about calling your husband. Now you'll have to do that, but I'm going to write a script for you. You will say exactly what I tell you to say. Not one word more. You understand?
I understand. Tony felt her heart pounding. She might not get another chance to warn Alex. She had to hope he would get the message she had been able to send. Los Angeles, California. They had almost finished breakfast when Michael's Virgil announced an incoming call. He had it off his belt in 2 seconds.
Yes. Sir, this is Chris Carroll, Military Ops. We just spoke to your wife at your house. She seems fine, sir.
Michaels blew out a sigh.
Thank God. She says she will call you, sir, after she has a nap. She must be tired from her workout.
What? What did you say?
Sir? About her being tired?
Sir, I just assumed she might be. She said she had been doing her aerobics. Michaels looked at John Howard.
He's there. He's got Tony.
Washington, D.C. The general had pulled strings and gotten them fast rides. The National Guard fighters had zipped from Los Angeles to the East Coast at speeds more than twice supersonic. By the time they were on the ground again, the trip had only been a little over 2 hours. It was almost 2:30 in the afternoon when the escort picked Michaels, Howard, and Jay up at the airbase and took off with lights flashing and sirens screaming. They'd shut those off before they got to his neighborhood. Howard set up a command post a half mile away from the house. An hour into the flight, Tony had called, and it had twisted his stomach to hear her speak the words that Burshaw must have made her say. I'm sorry I missed your call earlier. Listen, I can't talk now. I've got my mother on the other line. Some crisis with my sister-in-law she has to settle. Call me when you get to the airport tonight, okay? Bye. He put in a call to Tony's mother in the Bronx. She was surprised to hear from him, and he pretended he was calling to check on Tony's Silat teacher. Guru was doing okay, his mother-in-law told him. If he needed any confirmation, that did it. Tony wasn't talking to her mother.
How do you want to play it? Howard asked as the Net Force car careened toward the city. You want to call in the FBI kidnap teams?
Would you call them if it was your wife?
No, sir.
We have snipers, don't we?
Yes, sir.
Have them meet us at the staging point. I'll try to get him in front of a window. If they have a shot, tell them to take it. It will have to be in the spine or the head to be sure to drop him.
Yes, sir.
Howard pulled his Virgil and made a call.
You're not going in there alone, are you, boss? We could storm the place, hit it with 50 guys.
And he could break Tony's neck before they got through the door.
No,
it's me he wants. If he's in my face, Tony can get clear.
And you might get dead.
Yeah, well, better me than her.
What he didn't say was that he still had the capsule Howard had found at the shooting site, and that if he took it before he went in, he'd be more than a match for the zombie. The drug would cancel Burshaw's advantage. But it was risky. What if he went crazy like some of the others who used it? Could he risk Tony's life and the baby's life like that? Michael stuck his hand into his pocket and fingered the capsule.
Devil or the deep blue sea, Alex. And you better decide soon. You don't know how long it'll take before the stuff kicks in.
Shit.
Tony was sure Alex had gotten her warning. She could hear it in his voice when she called. That meant he was on his way home, and he'd be here sooner than Burshaw expected him. Her greatest fear was he would try to sneak into the house and take on Burshaw alone. If she had not been pregnant, she would have already tried to take Burshaw down herself. She would risk that her skill could offset his drug-powered strength. Silat was a weapons-based art. A knife from the butcher block rack wouldn't take a second to pull. No matter how resistant to pain a man might be, he couldn't walk if his spine was severed. She wouldn't risk the baby unless there was no other way. If it came down to it, she would not let this psychotic kill Alex. You didn't stand by and allow the man you loved to die if you could prevent it, no matter what it cost you. She had already rehearsed grabbing the knife in her mind a dozen times, never looking at it so as to give it away, but planning how to step. Right now, she had to pee.
Tad, I need to go to the bathroom.
Let's go.
He followed her down the hall.
Go ahead.
Can I close the door?
No. Just pee. I'll look the other way.
Thank you.
While the woman was on the john, Tad turned away and dry-swallowed two more of the hammer caps, and a few seconds later he took a third. He had built up a tolerance to the stuff by now. He heard the toilet flush, turned and saw the wife stand up, her robe falling to cover the short nightgown. She had good legs under that rounded, pregnant belly. Maybe that was worth exploring, even though it wouldn't be his first choice. But there was something else he wanted to do first. The wife could watch him trash her husband's toy.
Come on, he said. We have stuff to do in the garage.
He led her down the hall.
Sir, the snipers are set. We've got three, two in front, one in back. If they see him, he's history.
Thank you, John.
Howard handed Michaels his revolver.
Point it at his head just like you would point your finger at his nose and pull the trigger. A headshot is the only way to be sure to stop him.
Michaels took the heavy black handgun.
You have six shots. Don't say a word. Don't hesitate. If you get a shot, take it. If you don't, he'll kill you.
I got it.
Leave your Virgil on and sending. As soon as we see Tony or you indicate that she is clear, we'll come in.
Michaels nodded. His mouth was dry.
Good luck, Alex.
Michaels took a couple of deep breaths and started toward his home to save his wife. He was half a block away when he realized he had made his choice about taking the hammer cap. No. His mind was his best tool, and he did not want to risk Tony's life on his mind being fuzzed, even if it gave him the strength of Hercules. He would have to do it the hard way. Tony watched, feeling detached, as Burshaw swung the pry bar and punched a bar-shaped hole through the safety glass windshield. It took four or five hits, and the windshield was gone. He had already done the headlights and taillights. After the windshield, he shattered all the remaining glass. Then he started on the front fender, alternating the hammer and pry bar like some kind of mad drummer following a tune only he could hear. The destruction was terrible to watch. More terrible was Burshaw's expression. He was laughing, having the time of his life. Tony realized that attacking this man would be suicide if she made even the tiniest mistake, even with a knife. After what seemed like a long time, he dropped the bent pry bar, rolled his shoulders, then turned to look at her.
What would you do to save your husband's life?
Anything.
He grinned.
Good. I've something in mind. Let's go to the bedroom.
Tony felt a small surge of hope. If he wanted sex, he would have to put himself into a more vulnerable position. He would have to allow her to get close. Silat was an in-your-face art. If he let her get close, she would have a chance. She might be able to take him. Michaels tucked the gun into his back pocket as he slid open the garage window. He had heard the noise half a block away, and by the time he got to the garage, he had a pretty good idea of what he would see. He was wrong. What he saw was much worse than he'd expected. The Chevy looked as if it had rolled off a cliff. He climbed through the window, pulled the revolver out, and edged into the doorway and into the house. In the bedroom, Tad said,
"Get on your hands and knees."
The woman climbed onto the bed and did what he said.
He moved to stand behind her. He reached out with both hands, exposing her bare bottom. He reached for his zipper. Tony gathered herself as she heard the sound of his zipper. A twist, a hard fist to the testicles, grab and rip them off, roll to the side and onto the floor. Michael stepped into the bedroom, saw Burshaw's back to him, Tony beyond him on the bed. The bastard was about to rape his wife. He pointed the gun at the back of Burshaw's head and started to squeeze the trigger. Tad heard something, or maybe he felt the air pressure in the room change. Suddenly, he knew they weren't alone. He spun. There was the husband, with a gun. Good. Tad lunged. Michaels saw Burshaw spin. His speed was incredible, and leap at him. He was halfway through squeezing the trigger. Fast as Burshaw was, Michaels was ahead of him. The gun went off. Burshaw tried to duck, but the bullet hit him. Michaels saw it plow a furrow into his skull, just under the hairline. Burshaw kept coming, but the bullet's impact changed his angle a little, so he veered to the left slightly. Michaels dodged to his right, and Burshaw almost missed him. Almost. His flailing hand smashed into the revolver and tore it from Michael's grasp. The gun flew, and Burshaw slammed into the dresser and landed on his hands and knees. But he looked up at Michaels and smiled. Smiled, with blood oozing from the head wound. The bullet hit at an angle and glanced off, Michaels realized. He had to get this maniac away from Tony, who was on the floor next to the bed. Michaels grabbed the small television set on the stand next to the door and threw it at Burshaw, who batted it aside like it was a pillow. The TV set hit the floor and ruptured. He had to lead him out of here, away from Tony. Michaels turned and ran for the living room.
Come and get me, asshole!
Michaels risked a glance at his Virgil. As soon as Burshaw came after him, Tony would be safe. The general's men would be ready to hit the door when they heard Michaels yell for them.
Oh, shit! It was gone. The Virgil was gone. Where had he lost it? The window?
He didn't have time to worry about that now. He made it to the living room, and he looked around frantically for a weapon. He saw the little wooden case with the two karambit knives in it. He jerked the lid off just as Burshaw came into the room. The man was moving a little slower. He was a little unsteady on his feet. The bullet glancing off his head must have had some effect. Burshaw grabbed the end of the couch as Michaels ran behind it, trying to slip the rings of the little curved knives onto his index fingers. Burshaw heaved, and the couch came off the floor and twisted, flew 5 feet, and landed upside down with a crash.
"You can run, but you can't hide. Joe Lewis said that, did you know?
What do you want?
You killed Bobby. I kill you. Even trade.
I didn't kill him. He was shot by a rogue NSA agent working for the drug companies. That man is dead, too.
Doesn't matter. You pointed the shooter at him. You get to pay."
Burshaw moved in, his hands held out to grab. Michaels had the little curved-bladed knives gripped solidly now, hidden behind his forearms and closed hands, only the forefinger rings showing. Burshaw just kept coming, moving like some Frankenstein's monster that couldn't be stopped. Michaels took a deep breath and held it. It might be his last. Tony hurried down the hall. In her hand, she held the kris that Guru had given her, the wavy-bladed Javanese dagger that had been in the old lady's family for years. She heard a loud noise, felt the floor shake as she reached the living room. Burshaw advanced on Alex. Alex stood in a juru stance, and Tony immediately realized he had the karambits in his hands. Even with a head wound, the man was supernaturally fast. He lashed out with one hand, and before Alex could move, he caught him with a slap that knocked him backward into the bookcase, showering him with hardbacks.
"Hey!" Tony yelled.
Burshaw turned, smiled at her.
"I'll take care of you later. Better put that down before you cut yourself, honey."
The distraction was enough for Alex to recover a little. He grabbed several books from the shelf behind him and threw them at Burshaw. Tad turned back to finish Michaels. He saw 3 books coming at him in slow motion. He dodged them. Michaels was right behind the books, though, and just quick enough to get a punch in on him before Tad could block it. His vision went out on the left side, just flashed red, and went away. Tad frowned and backhanded Michaels, knocking him sprawling over the overturned couch. He put his hand to his face, and it came away covered with blood and some kind of clear gel. His mind made the connection. The son of a bitch had ripped his eye out.
How?
Michaels came up, and Tad saw a little knife in his hand. Looked like a claw. Tad moved in.
Something hit him in the back, and he felt a stab of minor pain. He reached around, realized the wife had thrown that fucking curvy blade and stuck it up in the middle of his back. He grabbed the thing by the blade, pulled it out, and brought it around in front of himself. He waved at the woman.
Thanks. Just what I needed.
He turned in time to see Michaels come over the couch, that little knife leading. Tad grinned. He still held the wavy knife by the blade, but he jammed the somewhat dull point at Michael's forearm, felt it grate on bone. Michael's hand spasmed open, so much for his little claw, but the knife didn't fall. It was as if it was glued to his fucking hand. Fine, fine, you want to play? Tad jerked his own weapon free, shifted his grip, and figured he'd just get a good swing and take the whole arm off. After that, he'd just carve the bastard up in little chunks. That's what... Michaels felt the kris go into his right forearm, felt Burshaw jerk the kris free, and knew the man was going to chop down. Knew with his maniacal strength the man might cleave Michaels' hand completely off. But he had the other karambit, and now he was close, inside, right where a Silat Serak player wanted to be when it all came down. He had one chance, and he took it. He lashed out in a punch at Burshaw's neck, a short left hook, twisting his fist as he threw it. The tiny blade of the karambit bit into the right side of Burshaw's neck a couple of inches below the jaw and ripped a channel all the way to his Adam's apple. The man frowned and paused in his downstroke. Michaels let his legs go limp. It was the fastest way to get clear, and as he fell, he punched with the knife again, scoring a nasty slash across Burshaw's thigh just below his groin. Burshaw drew back his unwounded leg and kicked. His foot took Michaels in the side just under the armpit, and he felt and heard ribs crack. A wet snap, snap that stole his breath. Blood fountained from Burshaw's neck, like a torn garden hose spraying water under pressure. Burshaw kicked him again, but not as hard. Michaels managed to turn a little, so he caught it on the shoulder. Muscle tore, but he didn't think the arm broke. Michaels hooked his right foot behind Burshaw's right ankle, then drove his left heel into the bloody cut on Burshaw's thigh. Burshaw lost his balance and fell backward, slamming into the couch. Michaels rolled away and up. He held the karambit in his left hand up point first at Burshaw. The right side of Burshaw's body was soaked in blood from the carotid artery Michaels had sliced open. The blood still pulsed out, but with less force now. Burshaw came up, grinned, and took two steps toward Michaels. But now it was his turn to move in slow motion. Michaels stabbed at him. Burshaw put up an arm, and the blade scored a line from the wrist to the elbow, but it hardly bled at all. Tad suddenly felt tired. So very tired. Yeah, he had to kill this guy. For Bobby. But as soon as he did that, he was going to have to go sit down. The hammer was slowing. He could feel it. And it wasn't time yet. Not yet. Just this one thing left to do first. Then he could take a break. Go see Bobby. Bobby? Something about Bobby. Fuck it. Kill the guy, then worry about it. Burshaw grabbed Michael's knife arm with both hands and squeezed. Michaels felt his wrist crack, and in desperation he snapped his other elbow out in a horizontal shot right out of Juru 1, out in front of him, only with all his weight behind it. He hit Burshaw square on the temple. Man, who would have thought this guy could hit so hard? He'd have to tell Bobby about this. But he felt so tired, so weak. It was so much trouble just to stand here, and why should he even bother? The hammer left him then, all by himself, here with this stranger who hit him. The gray closed in on Tad.
Bobby, is that you, man?
The light in Burshaw's remaining eye flickered as he let go of Michael's arm and stumbled back a step. Then the light went out, and Burshaw fell. A puppet with his strings cut. Michaels turned and saw Tony, a book gripped in her hands, advancing toward them. In that odd interplay that sometimes happened in scary situations, he noticed the title of the book, and he started to laugh. Tony stopped.
Alex, are you all right?
He waved at the book.
You were going to hit him with that?
Tony looked at it. It was How to Win Friends and Influence People. Washington, D.C. Michael's arm itched, and he wanted to tear off the plastic flesh bandage and scratch the cut.
He had pain medicine if he needed it for the broken wrist that ached dully and the cracked ribs that hurt every time he breathed, but nothing seemed to help with the itching. He sat in the kitchen nook at the table, looking at Tony as she came back from the fridge with a beer for him.
Thanks. You should have let me get that.
I'm in better shape than you, pregnancy notwithstanding. He took a sip, put the bottle down on the table. So, what's the latest from the office?
Well, it turned out that Lee and George were working for the drug company like we thought. Lee is trying to cut a deal, but I don't think he has enough leverage.
So why did they kill the chemist?
That's the twist. The pharmaceutical house they were in cahoots with...
Did you just say, in cahoots with?
You want me to tell this story or not? He grinned.
Go ahead.
It turned out the drug company already had a similar line of research going, upon which they had spent a lot of money and in which they had a lot of confidence. They had already started some testing protocols, gotten some government approvals, and they didn't want somebody stealing their thunder.
They were trying to suppress drain stuff?
Yeah. George and Lee had been given big blocks of stock to make sure drain's formulas didn't wind up on anybody else's table. If their company reached the market first, they'd be millionaires.
She shook her head. Huh. Didn't see that one.
Nobody else did either.
What about John Howard?
Michaels took another sip of his beer.
He says he is going to retire. Says life is too short and he wants to be around when his son graduates from school and goes out into the world on his own.
I don't blame him for that.
Me neither.
Jay Gridley still a Buddhist?
Mostly lapsed, if there is such a thing. He can't sit and contemplate his navel and stay sharp enough to run with the bad boys online, he says. He'll have to work all that out, but he and his girl are going to get married.
That's great.
Going to honeymoon in Bali, so he says.
And what about us?
Us? We're fine. I guess I won't be spending much time in the garage until the Chevy gets back from the body shop. Incredible what damage he did.
Yes, it was. I can see why so many people wanted to get their hands on this drug. If he had been a jock on this stuff, he could have taken the entire house down to the foundations.
He nodded.
Tell you what, if I ever complain about things being slow at work again, I want you to slap me upside the head.
My pleasure. They smiled at each other, and despite his aches and itches, Michaels was very happy to be able to do that. It sure beat the other options.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. To order additional cassettes or to receive a complete catalog of Harper Audio and Cadman titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. That's 1-800-331-3761. Thank you.